So you guys ready to go? All right, good afternoon, everybody. So welcome to the regularly scheduled quarterly meeting of the State Historical Resources Commission. The meeting is now convened. Today's meeting of the State Historical Resources Commission has been duly noticed. Any and all agenda items are subject to action by the Commission. So you guys, our flag is in the back. If you would please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
We have a real one that
way. Yeah, we have a real one in the back. So if you can't see it, just it's back there, all right?
It's the cemetery flag.
Yeah. You guys ready? I pledge allegiance
to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That's the
most dysfunctional thing. Thank you, guys. So before introductions, I would like to thank the CPF for setting this up and allowing us to join their conference. Also, I believe a couple individuals should be noticed, and that's previous Shippo Wayne and where's Wayne?
Where's
I saw him a minute ago.
He's here if he left.
He made his appearance and left. He will be back. And then Steve. Where's Steve? Steve, how you doing? All right, so introductions. Good afternoon again. My name is Brian Brandis, the chair and represent the public, and I'm from Southern California. Can we get Mr. Marshall to introduce himself and then the rest of the commissioners?
Good morning. My name is Marshall McKay. I'm from Yolo County, California. I'm with the Southern Wintun Tribe at the Yochidihi Wintun Nation, and I represent folklore on this commission.
Okay. Hi, I'm Beth Edwards Harris, and I represent architecture on the commission.
Hello. My name's Adrian Pratzelis. I'm an archaeologist, and I represent archaeology.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Augusta.
Just make it
so you just have to speak. Get kind of out a little.
How is that?
Further.
Bring it closer to your mouth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, turn it to the right.
Hello, everyone. My name is Alberto Bertoni. I'm an architect and I represent architecture.
Good afternoon. I'm Rick Moss. I am from Alameda, California. I represent ethnic history.
Thank you. And now, Ms. Blanco, you can introduce yourself and your staff.
Thank you. I'm Julie Polanco. I'm the State Historic Preservation Officer. I'll start with our Deputy Janon Saunders and ask our staff to introduce themselves.
Twyla Willis Hunter, staff.
And Tara Lynch, Chief Counsel, California State Parks.
Eric? We have Eric Allison in the audience as well. And then we have our certified local government staff in the other room having a workshop today. Thank you.
Thank you. So today we have Cindy Heitzman, Executive Director, who would like to give us some welcoming remarks.
Thank you, members of the commission, Julie Polanco, our SHPO, staff of the OHP, welcome to the 41st Annual California Preservation Conference at the San Francisco Presidio. It is our honor to have you here today, and we make a place for the commission at every conference because the work that you do is important. We thank you. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the signing of the National Historic Preservation Act by President Lyndon Johnson. And this conference, like the three that preceded it, have been looking forward to this day, this week, where we hold this conference and look back at our challenges and our successes and look forward at the work that we have yet to do. So you play a very important role in that.
The next 2 days after this will be filled with sessions that are looking at preservation in California, and we're bringing together over 120 speakers, over 500 attendees at this year's conference. It's one of our largest in a very long time. And this marks our second conference at the Presidio. We were here 12 years ago in 2004. And at that time, Julie Polanco and I served on the conference program committee when I was in my former job and she was with the San Francisco Presidio. So it's been a long time, a lot of changes in between. We hope that today's meeting is productive. We thank you for the good work that you do. And I would also like to give a shout out for your staff who do a phenomenal job. Thank you so very much for the work that you do and the partnership with the California Preservation Foundation and preservation organizations around the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again for the comments for the staff. Every meeting they always get good comments, so thank you. All right, moving on. The resolution has, we're actually going to move that to the next commission meeting. Is there any feedback?
Yeah, if the other commissioners could turn their mics off when they're not speaking, I think that'll help. Thank you.
Yeah. One other comment is if you... We have a number of speaker cards, but if you do plan to speak or would like to speak throughout the any time today, make sure you fill out a speaker card and turn it in. Okay, next item is the approval of our minutes. So all the commissioners have received a copy of the draft minutes from the January 29th, 2016 meeting. Does any commissioner have any proposed revisions? No? Okay, then may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
It's moved. Second?
Second.
Okay, great. So now we'll do a roll call vote. So, Alberto?
Aye.
Beth, aye.
Marshall, aye.
Rick, aye.
And Brian, aye as well. So motion carries. Next, we'll move to the committee reports, or actually the commission and staff reports. I do not have one. Julie, would
you? No report? Sure. Good morning, or good afternoon, everyone. I think we're all a little off usually morning meetings. It is a particular pleasure for me to be in this role in this room. I started my career in preservation in 1999 as a historic preservation specialist for the Presidio Trust, so it's a nice homecoming, and I'm happy to see so many people in the audience today. It's an auspicious day for San Francisco in that it's the anniversary of the 1906 earthquake, so everybody get up and shake a little, and then I think we'll get it over with. But just to mention that. Just a couple of updates. So far, in our programs, in our tax credit program, we are ninth in the country with 55 active reviews, with some $208,705,000, so pretty impressive numbers. Our CLG group, our Certified Local Governments group, we'd like to say that the City of Redlands is our newest CLG. They were approved on April 11th, and we have about 67 of 540 local governments now participating in that National Park Service program. We'd like to see more. Our CLG group is unfortunately competing with us for your attention right now in a workshop in the next room, but the following workshops are going to be in September at Sac State, October in Napa, and November in Fresno. And if you'd like more information about the particular topics of those, they're on our website. Last November, we were honored to give a Governor's Award to the Presidio of San Francisco Officers Club Project. So take a look and go see that nice project. But I also wanted to mention that the application time is open for the Governor's Awards for this year. The deadline is May 11th. Applicants will be notified in September and the awards will be presented in November. So we'd encourage everybody to spread the word, get lots of applications. We'd like to see lots of projects. We know
your hard work is happening, and we'd like to be able to honor that with these in this process. We are also going to begin very soon this summer the statewide historic preservation plan update. It's for the period of 2018 through 2022. When I saw that, I thought, why are we starting so soon? But we'll take a year to do it. We're going to have lots of public input opportunities. I really encourage you to think about the things that you're hearing here about what are we doing in the next 50 years, where are we going with preservation, and help us think about how we together formulate what we're looking at going forward. So that work will begin in the summer. Speaking of the 50th anniversary of the National Historic Preservation Act, we have a Pictures of Success in honor of the NHPA anniversary effort going on. You can go to our website. I think that there's an announcement in your registration brochures if you're part of the conference. We're accepting photos of sites to honor in that capacity on our media, multimedia burst. So we'd like to ask you to help us and send us your projects and sites. So that's what's sort of happening in our office. I had the pleasure of giving a talk at the California Society of Archaeologists, Society of California Archaeologists. Yeah, Jennifer? Earlier this year, and it was quite an honor to be with so many smart colleagues who taught me a lot of things about obsidian and carbon dating and all those things, and so it was nice to be with them. I've most recently been in Los Angeles, spending some time now getting out and looking at projects, and so last week looked at a lot of Caltrans projects, and all I can say is California is still a very big car culture. Down there. And then I've also been participating with the National Park Service and their Multiple Voices effort, which is looking at the National Historic Landmark criteria and ways to reflect on what the National Historic Landmarks program is now, what we've honored, and collecting the history that we've missed, looking at diversity, sites that have less physical integrity but sites of story. There's a couple of LGBTQ nominations. And so it's been a really interesting conversation. I will just say that a lot of good thought is going on to start that conversation about how we collect the diverse stories that have happened in the last 50 years so that we know where we're going in the next 50 years. And so the Park Service, I think, is really leading an amazing effort to understand criteria for those sites, particularly those of intangible heritage. And so stay tuned for that. And I think that's the extent of our report. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So now moving to the committee reports. Adrian.
Is this hearable? No, I didn't think so. I got this stuck at the top
of
the way
out. None of those work, huh?
This one does really well.
Okay, all right.
It's just you.
How's that? I can project. I'm a teacher. We do that stuff. Well, thanks for the kind comments about smart archaeologists. I'm still looking for those, but I'm allowed to say that. All right, so here's my report on the Archaeological Resources Committee. So the committee met at the Society for California Archaeology Conference in Ontario on March 12th. Since Anne-Marie Meaden's resignation, the committee actually consists of me, but we do have another structure called the Working Group, which actually does the work of the committee. The main topic under discussion were the achievements of the committee over the last 8 years in order to further the goals of the State Historic Preservation Plan as outlined in our white papers. As well, the committee was also interested in defining our role moving forward. In relation to the standards and guidelines white paper, the committee has revised the existing guidance document called Archaeological Resources Management Reports, or ARMA, and the revision was put out for public review in the fall of last year, and the result was 139 individual comments, which were addressed in a revised draft. Meanwhile, Julie, Jeppo asked Council, Tara, to review this work to ensure that the Commission and OHP were acting within their legal authority to issue an updated version of the ARMA as guidance. And it's my understanding that Council has determined that OHP and or the Commission does indeed have that authority. And I anticipate continued work on the ARMA, possibly at a workshop at the next Commission meeting. The education white paper topic, on that one, working group member Greg Castro is working to update educational guidelines for California elementary school curriculum about California Indians, which really needs some work. On the curation topic, working group members Wendy Teeter and Myra Herman will also work on an archaeological collections related survey to assess the status of these collections, that is physical objects. How many of these collections are there, where are they, and what kind of condition are they in? These are primarily collections of artifacts collected under the authority of CEQA. Anyway, the Society of California Archaeology is said that they're willing to circulate this survey, so hopefully we'll get some results and figure out where all this stuff is. And that is the end of my report. Thank you.
Beth, you're next. Do you have something?
Okay, I'm the chair of the Modernism Committee, and we continue to work on our two initiatives. One is an outreach initiative. We've been working closely with Diane Barclay and staff at OHP to try to connect the people around the state, stakeholders and organizations that are interested in mid-century modern architecture, and with an ultimate goal of creating a listserv, much like the CLG listserv, to connect these groups who deal and grapple with similar issues when it comes to 20th century architecture. And that's going really well. We put together, our working group put together a pretty extensive database, and now we're doing outreach to get permission to put them onto a listserv. And we also handed out interest forms at Modernism Week at the panel that we had there. And we've gotten some feedback for the, through that as well. And the OHP has put us onto the website as well and onto their Facebook so we can try to get feedback. And the success of the CLG listserv and the usefulness of it is such an important thing. We think that this is going to be something that's very helpful for a state this large to share resources and ideas. And then the second initiative, which we started last year, or a little 2 years ago, was to look at how modern resources are evaluated on the National Register application, or the practical stories. And we began to look at integrity issues and some of the challenges that mid-century modern resources face because they change much more quickly and much more intentionally, and how that relates to the criteria. So we put together a series of case studies and presented them at Modernism Week last year and at the CPF conference last year, and a different panel at Modernism Week this year, with yet a different panel tomorrow at the CPF conference. And with these case studies, we really feel like we can contribute to the conversation that's going on around the country about preservation, the applications for state, local, or national register nominations. So we will be making the determination after this conference on how we want to put together the information and distribute it. We don't know if it's going to be a white paper or an article or what, but we do have a lot of data now, so we have to go to the next place with it. So that is what we have been working on. We do meet monthly. We are always looking for people interested in modern architecture to get into the conversation, and we are posted on the website, as I think every committee is. So everybody is welcome to jump on the call, and you can talk about your local issues, you can talk about your interest in state and local nominations. It's been a really fascinating journey, and to get the Modernism Committee up and going again. So we welcome all participation.
Great, thank you. Alberto, were you next? Oh, no, Adrian.
Oh, sorry.
I forgot about you, Rick.
You sure did. That's
you want to go ahead, Rick?
No, go ahead.
All right, here I go again. So I'm reporting on the Information Center Procedural Advisory Committee, known as the ICEPAC. So that is the subcommittee that has to do with the California Historical Resources Information System. So the ICEPAC met once again at the Society for California Archaeology Conference in Ontario. That's Ontario, California, which was very confusing to me. Anyway, on 11th of March, I'm just a foreigner, what can I say? So one goal of the meeting was to get people to participate in the online CRIS survey that focused on assessing what functions the information centers should be carrying out in the future. And between Eric Allison and I, mostly Eric, thank you very much, Eric, we presented an update on the status of the transition study and the development of a transition plan. Essentially, that OHP finished its analysis of the CRIS structure and services by June of this year, and that this was going to lead to the development of a transition plan by March of next year. There was a lot of good discussion about what functions the ICs should carry out in the new structure. In fact, there was a lot of discussions, and the thing went on for quite a long time, but just to cut to the chase here, five main points. First was that the IC's functions are going to be necessarily limited by the funding that's available. Another point was that the IC's, an important function of the IC's is to train the next generation of cultural resource managers, that is upcoming professionals. Also that the IC's have an important role in the CEQA process, as they don't just provide data, but also interpretation of those data for public agencies that don't have trained personnel. However, some users, another point, some users don't believe that they should have to pay for services, such as outreach to municipalities, that they don't themselves use. So that was another point. Two other interesting issues. First, there was some discussion about the relationship of the information centers to the new AB 52 process. As you know, or maybe you don't know, OHP doesn't have a statutory role, but the ICs are part of the process as defined in OPR's draft guidelines, which is sort of a bit confusing to some folks. Anyway, and finally, somewhat apropos considering where we're meeting here, it was pointed out that many architectural historians do not contribute their records to the CRIS system, and the result is that the vision of CRIS as a coordinated system for information about all categories of historical resources, as it was kind of figured out in the 1990s, hasn't really materialized, and we have to figure out a way to get everybody to participate in this effort. And that's the end of my report, Mr. Chairman. So,
great, thank you. Rick?
Yes.
Wouldn't forget about you.
I'm not thin-skinned anyway. just a brief report from the Cultural Diversity Committee. At least one half of that committee, because due to my zeal in moving forward and trying to get some momentum behind what I've been calling the initiative to establish a California African American Heritage Trail, I failed to share my thoughts with my co-chair, Commissioner McKay, so I'm going to ask for his forgiveness on that and do better in the future to communicate the kinds of things that are going on. So, having been forgiven, I have been following trying for the past probably 5 or 6 months to really get some momentum behind, again, the establishment of a California African American Freedom Trail. And since that's such a big piece to bite off, I logically thought that a good place was to start was in my own backyard, that being Oakland. So to that extent, I've in the past few months been in touch with the Oakland Heritage Alliance, partly to let them know about this initiative and what I've been trying to do, but also partly to get in touch with them to discuss whether or not they'd be interested in even being a partner in this venture. In early March, I was invited to speak to their board, and I took that opportunity to speak in greater detail about a variety of things. Most importantly, I thought, was ways in which we might generate community volunteer interest to form the working groups that we're going to need, a lot of working committees and such, but also potentially some local sites for local designation that came out of that meeting. So, you know, that's key, forming these working committees, because it's going to take a lot of people to make this thing happen. And to that end, I was also invited by the board to submit an article to the OHA newsletter, and I indeed have written kind of open letter encouraging those who might be interested to contact me in the letter so we can start forming some of these committees in Oakland. A few weeks ago, I was in a small town in North Carolina called Princeville, North Carolina. Princeville's on the coastal plain in eastern North Carolina, and it has the distinction of being the oldest black chartered town in America. It was originally called Freedom Hill, and it was established by recently emancipated African Americans in 1865. And in 1885, it was incorporated and changed its name then to Princeville in honor of one of its founders. And this is obviously a very important historical site that people should know more about, but I found out that people didn't know anything about it very little about it even in North Carolina. Even in a state that pays a lot of attention to its history, especially Civil War history, you would think that there would be even a marker off of the freeway, advertising this place, but it didn't. And it doesn't have one, so I thought that was a bit strange, since the entire eastern seaboard is filled with Civil War, trails and trials and reenactments and everything, but nothing in poor little Princeville. In North Carolina is also in the news these days for things that are not quite as, palatable as Civil War trails, but that's another discussion for another day. But anyway, somehow Little Princeville is practically forgotten. And I was there as a peer reviewer for the American Alliance of Museums, and I was on assignment in Princeville to look at what they call the Princeville Museum and Visitor Center, a very wonderful place, well apportioned and well-meaning, but pretty much empty. And since my job is to gather information that will result in a report that will address a lot of their challenges and their issues, and hopefully to help them to solve some of their problems, I couldn't help but thinking myself, well, these problems mostly are they suffer from recognition and revenue, or lack of revenue, and those are the same kinds of issues that I'm dealing with here in terms of the California Trail. But I couldn't help but thinking, here's Princeville, North Carolina. It's just one site, one historical site in the middle of a very historical area. You would think they'd get lots of attention, and I'm thinking about the entire state of California. I'll tell you that trip certainly put the Heritage Trail in perspective for me. It's going to be really difficult, not impossible, but it's going to, again, take the efforts of a great many people. So finally, with respect to the work I'm doing with the California African American Heritage Trail, is in the next few weeks I will also be meeting with several members of the City of Oakland's Landmark Heritage Board to talk more about identifying and designating properties that fit the project criteria and also to get the city really vested in starting, at least helping to start the trail in Oakland. So that's my report.
Great. Thank you. All right, moving on. The next, the staff will provide a PowerPoint presentation of the properties being considered for the registration during today's meeting. One item to note is item number 2 on the consent calendar, the Renwick House, is being pulled from the consent calendar, and we're moving it to the discussion and action items, so we will discuss it there. So if you can hold off on your presentation on that one.
X100 is a steel structure, single-family residence located in San Mateo, San Mateo County. Built by developer Eichler Homes in 1955 and 56 to designs by the architectural team Jones and Emmons and landscape architect Douglas Bayless, the building was intended as a prototype for steel beam homes to be built by Eichler's development firm. All structural elements, including posts and roof beams, are steel, exposed inside and out. No interior walls are structural, thanks to a structural system designed by engineer William R. Mason, allowing for an expansive open plan. Skylights add to this open feeling, provide illumination for 2 indoor gardens. Rear walls are entirely glass, and indoor-outdoor connections are emphasized by continuity of materials, concrete paving pads, outdoor garden connection from every room, and indoor gardens. X100 is eligible for the National Register under Criterion C as a unique design by architect Frederick Emmons and A. Quincy Jones. The building illustrates important aspects of mid-century modern architecture, including new materials and technological advances, an open plan with extensive integration between indoor and outdoor spaces, and the aesthetics of California living in the 1950s. Even the name X100 suggests the prototype aircraft produced by California's aerospace industry in the 1950s that tested theories later expressed in production military aircraft known by the designation X for experimental. Although the experiment represented by X100 did not result in mass-produced homes as planned, and X100 became one of only 2 steel houses built by Eichler, it served as an experimental testbed for concepts that were later used in other homes. The property is nominated on behalf of the property owner, who has provided a letter of support for the nomination. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends that the State Historical Resources Commission determine that X100 is eligible for listing in the National Register under Criterion C at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1955 to 1956. The Los Angeles Plaza Historic District encompasses approximately 9.5 acres in downtown Los Angeles and includes 21 contributing and 8 non-contributing resources, dating from the early 19th century to the early 20th century. The district was first listed on November 3, 1972, and amended in 1981 to include 5 additional contributors and provide more information on 2 originally listed buildings. This second amendment to the district nomination is intended to fulfill the following objectives: reframe the nomination in accordance with contemporary historic resource evaluation and preservation standards. Add, remove, and reclassify contributing resources, including the Plaza Search Cemetery, covered with a parking lot but recently partially excavated, and remove the demolished Brunswick Annex from listing. The district is eligible under Criterion A for its role in the early settlement of Los Angeles during the Spanish, Mexican, and American periods from 1818 until 1930. During the later portion of the period of significance, the district was envisioned as the site of a social and commercial center intended to highlight the cultural heritage of colonial Los Angeles. This district was interpreted by early 20th century Los Angeles boosters, including philanthropist Christine Sterling, within the context of romanticized ideas about the Spanish colonial and Mexican periods. The district is also eligible under Criterion C as a rare assemblage of early Los Angeles architectural styles, including adobe, Italianate, Victorian-era two-part commercial, and Spanish colonial revival. The nomination was submitted on behalf of the City of Los Angeles. The Diocese of Los Angeles contacted the Office of Historic Preservation to clarify that a 1965 addition to the Old Plaza Church was not considered a contributing element to the district, but the nomination has not received any other public comment. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends that the State Historical Resources Commission support the determination that this amendment for the Los Angeles Plaza Historic District is eligible under criteria A and C at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1818 to 1930, and should be listed in the National Register.
The Holbrook Palmer Estate Water Tower and Carriage House. Located in Holbrook Palmer Park is a pair of 19th century agricultural outbuildings constructed as part of a rural estate historically known as the Holbrook Palmer Estate, or Elmwood. The older of the two buildings is the Water Tower, built by prominent San Francisco wholesale hardware dealer Charles C. Holbrook in circa 1883. It is a three-story heavy timber frame tank house built to store groundwater in a large redwood tank on the top floor. Water was then distributed by gravity to the nearby house, fields, gardens, and other outbuildings. The water tower is clad in redwood rustic channel siding, and it is embellished with applied ornament designed in the Second Empire style, a French-inspired architectural movement popular in the United States during the 1870s and early 1880s. Unusually elaborate for a utilitarian building type, the water tower is capped by an ornamental balcony and a French mansard roof clad in wooden shingles. Located across the driveway from the water tower is the General Merrill Carriage House. Built in 1897 by Holbrook to replace a barn destroyed earlier that year, the two-story heavy timber frame building features a carriage storage room, stables, and tack rooms on the first floor, and a large hayloft and bunkhouse on the second floor. The building is capped by a compound hip and gable roof that is crowned by a pyramidal roof ventilator. In contrast to the flamboyant water tower, the carriage house is designed in the restrained colonial revival style, an indigenous American architectural style popular during the 1890s. It is one of only a handful of remaining barns or carriage houses in Atherton. Both buildings are in very good condition and remain essentially unchanged from the late 19th century, providing a rare window into a now almost entirely vanished world of 19th century estates of southern San Mateo County. Both buildings retain integrity of location, design, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. Neither building retains the aspect of setting because the surrounding landscape was changed from a rural estate into a municipal park in the late 1960s. Nonetheless, the boundaries of the park correspond to the limits of the Elmwood Estate, and both buildings are still surrounded by open space. The water tower and the carriage house are eligible for the National Register at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture as a rare surviving pair of agricultural outbuildings constructed on one of the rural estates developed in Atherton during the late 19th century. The two periods of significance, 1883 and 1897, reflect the construction dates of each resource. The property is nominated on behalf of the owner. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that the Holbrook Palmer Estate meets National Register Criterion C at the local level of significance with two periods of significance, 1883 and 1897. Staff recommends that the State Historic Preservation Officer approve the nomination for forwarding to the National Park Service for listing in the National Register.
Yountville Grammar School is a Mission Spanish Colonial Revival style building situated on the corner of Yount Street and Finnell Road. The school was constructed in the early 1920s within what is likely the same parcel where the circa 1860 Yountville Grammar School once stood, on parcels donated to the town of Yountville by George Yount and Charles Hopper in 1855. The building's age was determined during investigation work for a structural strengthening project when historic wood floors were exposed, work that revealed hollow clay tile wall construction typical of the 1920s. The single-story building is approximately 4,500 square feet with a partial basement of 230 square feet. The building is asymmetrical, L-shaped in plan, with a wood frame and clad in stucco. The moderate pitched hipped roof has a slight eave overhang and extended rafter beams. Character-defining elements include a mission-style bell tower, a single prominent arched front entry doorway, multi-light wooden casement windows, wooden lintels and lug sills, a red clay tile roof, a hipped angled bay window, and Spanish eclectic decorative wooden vents located within the bell tower. A non-contributing detached modular building of approximately 1,500 square feet was added in 2013. Yountville Grammar School possesses all aspects of integrity. The school is eligible for the National Register at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture as a rare, excellent example of the early 20th century mission Spanish colonial revival style. Portraying a romantic myth of California's pre-statehood colonial heritage, the mission Spanish colonial revival style was very popular in California from about 1900 to the early 1920s. Yountville Grammar School is one of three Spanish colonial revival style buildings remaining in the town of Yountville. The period of significance is 1920, the approximate year of its construction. Yountville Grammar School is an outstanding example of the style with very few exterior and interior alterations. The property is nominated on behalf of the owner, and no letters have been received to date. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that Yountville Grammar School meets National Register Criterion C at the local level of significance with a period of significance 1920. The First Church of Christ Scientist is located on the west end of a block consisting of one- and two-story apartment buildings, small hotels, and another church building. The area is isolated from the main thoroughfare of South Palm Canyon Drive by a large vacant parcel of land to the west and the generally dry Tahits River to the north. Constructed in 1956, the one-story church building is modest in size, exhibiting architectural elements associated with the work of Albert Frey, including a shed roof, deep eaves with metal fascia, sandblasted terracotta-colored concrete block construction, large windows, and slender steel posts. The building is in excellent condition and retains a high level of historic and physical integrity. The church is eligible for the National Register under Criterion C at the local level of significance in the area of architecture. The property embodies the distinctive characteristics of religious architecture associated with the modern movement, as interpreted by Albert Frey for the desert environment of the Coachella Valley. In addition, the property meets the architecture of Albert Frey multiple property submission registration requirements for religious buildings in association with the historic context, desert modern design in the Coachella Valley, 1934 to 1965. The property satisfies criteria consideration A, religious properties, because it derives its primary significance from architectural distinction as evaluated under Criterion C. The period of significance corresponds with the building's date of construction, 1956. The property is nominated on behalf of a group of private individuals. In its role as representative of the City of Palm Springs, a certified local government, the Historic Site Preservation Board has received a copy of the nomination. No letters have been received to date. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that the First Church of Christ Scientist meets National Register Criterion C at the local level of significance with a period of significance, 1956. Providence Townsite is located in the vicinity of the 7,162-foot Edgar Peak, high in the Providence Mountains in eastern San Bernardino County. Providence is mostly within the boundaries of and managed by Mojave National Preserve, a unit of the National Park Service. The 81-acre district sits at the base of steep cliffs and peaks at the top of an alluvial fan overlooking the Fenner Valley. The town site is clustered near the defunct Bonanza King Mine, one of the great silver mines of the 19th century. The district is composed of 47 stone buildings in various states of ruin, most of which include intact lower walls, 6 sites, and 17 structures. Of particular interest is the intact nature of the village as a whole, despite the ruined state of the individual buildings, with most known original buildings represented as well as a network of roads and trails. The buildings were constructed of 3 types of local stone, including examples of buildings made of carved blocks of soft volcanic tuff. While all but 2 individual buildings or structures are in a state of ruin, as a district, Providence Town Site possesses all aspects of integrity. Practically all of the buildings and structures dating from the period of significance remain in place and are further connected by the town's original road and trail system. Providence Town Site is eligible for the National Register under Criterion A in the areas of settlement, commerce, and transportation at the local level of significance for its association with Southern California settlements and the mining industry. It is eligible under Criterion C in the area of architecture at the local level of significance as an example of a distinctive building style utilizing local stone that shows varying designs and skills. The district is also eligible under Criterion D in the area of archaeology at the local level of significance for its potential to yield important information through archaeological investigation and further study. It can be seen that the occupants of Providence were engaged in activities that created features or durable remains in sufficient quantity for archaeological analysis, and evidence shows that archaeological remains have survived. Property types and research themes applicable to Providence include commercial and domestic behavior through building remains and potential archaeology, and to a lesser extent, infrastructure development and industry. The period of significance is 1880 to 1892, reflecting the dates that the physical design of the town was created, built, revitalized, and then largely abandoned. The property is nominated on behalf of Mojave National Preserve, a unit of the National Park Service. Approximately 13 acres of private land, part of the old Bonanza King mine, are included within the boundary, resulting in a concurrent nomination to be reviewed by the State Historical Resources Commission and certified by the State Historic Preservation Officer, as well as the National Park Service Federal Preservation Officer. No letters have been received to date. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that Providence Town Site meets National Register criteria A, C, and D at the local level of significance with a period of significance 1880 to 1892. Big Creek Hydroelectric System Historic District is a sprawling early 20th century hydroelectric generation and transmission system that begins on the western slopes of the Sierra Nevada in Fresno and Madera counties and extends to urban spheres in Tulare, Kern, and Los Angeles counties. The system is comprised of a range of interrelated facilities, including large dams, small diversions, flow lines, powerhouses, transmission lines, and substations that together serve to generate and transmit electricity from the upper San Joaquin River watershed to population centers located in the San Joaquin Valley and Southern California. In addition to the resources directly associated with the generation and transmission of hydroelectric energy, the district includes a number of resources developed to support construction and ongoing operation of the system, including several vehicular access roads, construction-related railroad inclines, and the remnants of a railroad alignment that was central to construction and early development of the system. While geographically expansive, with components of the system separated by tens and hundreds of miles of diverse terrain, as an operational system, the district resources reflect a united method and type of construction, innovative historical development context, and integrated functional cohesion. The historic integrity of the district is very high, with all contributing resources readily conveying significance through all aspects of integrity. In addition, the system conveys its significance through integrity of operation, with the historic period components of the system remaining vital to the development and transmission of energy in California and remaining much as they were developed in the early 20th century. As an intact and continuously operating assemblage, the district is an evocative portrait of California's development, intimately linked to the state's early 20th century population growth, industrial and commercial expansion, and national standing. The district is eligible for the National Register under Criterion A in the area of community planning and development, and in the area of engineering at the state level of significance for its association with the physical development of California and its influence on California's hydroelectric generation industry. The significance stems from the direct influence on the power supply of a rapidly developing early 20th century Los Angeles and environs, and its role as a catalyst and template for subsequent hydroelectric generation projects across the state that ultimately served to foster urban community growth across the state. The district is also eligible under Criterion C in the area of engineering at the state level of significance as an unparalleled California representative of early 20th century hydroelectric engineering and development. The period of significance for the district is 1909 to 1929. The period begins with initial construction of the hydroelectric system and spans the years of intensive foundational development that brought a hydroelectric system that was at the vanguard of technological and engineering innovation. In addition, the period of significance encompasses a critical phase of development for the hydroelectric industry as a whole. During this period, the industry developed and maintained an unrivaled centrality in California's explosive urban, industrial, and agricultural growth, with a complex engineering framework of water storage, conveyance, and generation providing the structural basis behind urban development hundreds of miles away. Following the period of significance that was characterized by a rapid succession of critical technological advances, many at Big Creek, the primacy of the hydroelectric industry was increasingly overshadowed by subsequent steam-based energy innovation that dominated California's electrical grid by the mid-20th century. Within this development context and period of significance, the district stands as a physical, technological, and environmental testament to the intimate and evolving relationship between water and energy in California's historical development. The property is nominated on behalf of and with the participation of the private owner. The United States Forest Service is also an owner, resulting in a concurrent nomination to be reviewed by the State Historical Resources Commission and certified by the State Historic Preservation Officer, as well as the U.S. Forest Service Federal Preservation Officer. Letters of support are on file from the Forest Service and Fresno County. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Big Creek Hydroelectric System Historic District meets National Register Criteria A and C at the state level of significance with a period of significance 1909 to 1929. Staff recommends the State Historic Preservation Officer approve these nominations for forwarding to the National Park Service for listing on the National Register. This concludes the consent calendar PowerPoint presentation.
Great, thank you. So the Commission will now hear nominations and any comments concerning the eligibility of the nominated properties for the National Register of Historic Places and the California Register of Historic Resources. Based on the evidence presented, including the nomination of any comments received regarding the nomination and the nominated properties, including testimony presented at this meeting, the Commission will determine whether the property or properties meets the criteria of applicable register program. For nominations to the National Register of Historic Places, the Commission will then make a recommendation to the State Historic Preservation Officer regarding forwarding the nomination to the Keeper of the National Register of Historic Places for action by the Keeper. For nominations to the California Register of Historic Resources, the Commission's determination shall be final. The Commission only considers evidence relating specifically to the applicable register criteria and not any social or economic matters related to a nomination. All properties that are listed or determined eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places are automatically listed in the California Register of Historic Resources. Furthermore, all properties listed in the California Registered Historical Landmark program, including and following landmark number 770, are automatically listed in the California Register of Historic Resources. The Commission first hears nominations to the National Register of Historic Places and California Register of Historic Resources that are on the consent calendar. Nominations are on consent because the Office of Historic Preservation is not aware of any opposition to the nominations. Information concerning the nominations on consent has been forwarded to each of the commissioners prior to the meeting and is on file at the Office of Historic Preservation at 1725 23rd Street in Sacramento, California. Unless a member of the audience or a commissioner requests that a nomination be removed from the consent calendar, the commission will not hear testimony on the nominations and will vote on a single motion. If a nomination is withdrawn from the consent calendar, the commission will hear testimony and consider such nomination later in today's meeting. So, in addition to the Renwick House, does any member of the audience request that a nomination be withdrawn from the consent calendar? Good. Does any commissioner request that a nomination be removed from the consent calendar?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Is there any commissioner that wishes to recuse oneself from hearing or voting on the consent calendar?
Yeah.
Good. So with that, we can entertain a motion.
I move to approve the items on the consent calendar and forward them to Keeper National Trust, National Register of Historic Places.
Your mic. Alberto, second? Perfect. You're doing a roll call vote. Alberto? Adrian?
Adrian.
Aye.
Beth?
Beth, aye.
Marshall, aye.
Rick, aye.
Brian, aye. So, motion carries. Consent calendar is approved. So we have a couple speakers that would like to speak on behalf of the consent calendar. The first one will be the mayor of Yountville and a couple commissioners, I believe. Council member. If you could just introduce yourself. Thank you.
The red light will go on. There you go.
Chair Brandison, Commission, my name is John Dunbar. I'm the mayor of the County of Yountville. I'm here with Councilmember Marita Dornbecker and Councilmember Marjorie Muller, as well as our town manager, Steve Rogers, and our planning director, Sandra Liston. We are here because we very much appreciate your consideration and your action today to recognize the efforts that we have taken in Yountville to preserve our pioneer heritage while we continue to evolve as a community. I'm going to now invite Councilmember Dornbecker to provide some of that, I'll start with Councilmember Muller, who will provide some of the pioneer significance that I'm sure factored into your consideration. Councilmember Dornbecker will address some of the more local significance.
So just briefly, I don't want to take up a lot of your time. In addition to its architecture, which you recognize today, this land of which our original schoolhouse, which is now our town hall, is on, was a part of Salvador Vallejo's original Mexican land grant. And shortly after, which he got in the late 1830s, and when the Bear Flag Republic occurred, he realized financially it would make a lot of sense to start selling that property. So he sold it to George Yount, who was one of the first white settlers on this side of California, along with Charles Hopper, his friend from Missouri, who came and led the first wagon train across to settle in that area in 1841. So it means a lot to us that it's still a public building in town, and thank you very much for your recognition today. And I'd like to introduce Council Member Dornbecker.
Thank you, Chair Brandis and the Commission, for this honor. We are delighted. And I just wanted to mention that in 2013, we started a seismic retrofit project on our town hall, and during which the wood floor was exposed, and then subsequently revealed the hollow clay tiles. So we undertook the retrofit in which we essentially built the structure inside the structure that was standing. And I must say we did an excellent job. We lost a little bit of interior ground space, But nonetheless, we kept it as close as possible to its original, including the original windows. We had the lead removed, but we still do have the original windows. And we completed that project in 2014, just before the earthquake of August 2014. So we really feel fortunate that we had no structural damage at all from that earthquake. And as you know, Napa did suffer quite a bit of damage, and I'm afraid we may have if we hadn't done what we did, but I'm delighted that we did. And please come and visit Yountville.
Great. Thank you. So next one is Linda Pollack. With the... No? Yeah, here she comes.
Hello. My name is Linda Pollack, and I am an archaeologist with Southern California Edison. I am their hydroelectric archaeologist. And I wanted to say that Big Creek is an absolutely spectacular place to work, as well as an amazing project. It provides electricity to Southern California and has been doing so for over 100 years now. Big Creek Hydroelectric System Historic District has been the subject of many books and television programs, including Huell Hauser's program, California's Gold. And it's been the subject of many books, Redinger's Story of Big Creek, Shoup's The Hardest Working Water in the World. There's Building the Ultimate Dam, the story of John S. Eastwood, and Johnson's The Railroad That Lit Southern California. Among many, there are just many. It's an amazing place. We invite you all to come up anytime. We'll give you a tour. On behalf of Southern California Edison, I would like to thank Amy Crane and Kathleen Edwards from the SHPO's office for all of their help throughout this nomination process. And I'd also like to thank Polly Allen and Eric Lee from Cardno. They did an excellent job with this nomination, and I especially wish to convey Southern California Edison's appreciation to the Commission for considering this project and passing it along. Thank you.
Thank you. Then the last card I have is David Weinstein.
Hi, my name is Dave Weinstein. I'm an architectural writer and a preservationist in El Cerrito, and I authored the nomination for the X100. I would really like to thank the commission for approval and for sending it along. I would particularly like to thank staff, because this was the first nomination I ever wrote, and I'm pretty good at history, but I'm not so good at details. Getting all the details right, I really have to thank staff. They really did it. The owner, Marty Arbenich, who was here in the audience, more than a decade ago, he worked to get Eichler neighborhoods on the National Register. They were three Eichler neighborhoods. They were the first Eichlers to be on the National Register. This is the next one. I really think that the preservation of modern residential landscapes is a really important issue. It's one that the magazine that Marty publishes, Marin, focuses on. And Marty, I just want to say, is working to restore the home right now following the Secretary of the Interior standards. So again, thank you very much. Thank you for your good work. Thank you.
Thank you. Take a break.
Yeah.
We are going to take a 5-minute break.
Ten.
Okay, a 10-minute break. Till we'll resume at maybe a 13-minute break at 2:15. Okay, you guys, if I can get your attention, we're going to probably start back up. Thank you. Okay, we're going to reconvene the meeting. So now we will hear the nominations to the National Register of Historic Places and California Register of Historic Resources that are on discussion and action items. Information concerning the nominations has been forwarded to each of the commissioners prior to this meeting and is on file at the Office of Historic Preservation at 1725 23rd Street in Sacramento. Office of Historic Preservation staff will first present their report regarding the nomination. The commission will then hear the testimony from proponents and then opponents each nomination. Each side will have 20 minutes total to present their information. As such, each side should determine how to allocate its time amongst all the speakers. Following the initial presentations, each side will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Public comments will be then closed. Then the commission will discuss the nomination. And I would like again to remind all speakers that the commission only considers evidence relating specifically to the applicable register criteria and not any social or economic matters related to the nomination or a nominated property. Before we proceed with the hearing, is there any commissioner that wishes to recuse himself from hearing any of these nominations? Okay, good. So staff will go ahead and start with the first one.
Rockhaven Sanitarium Historic District is 3.4 acres in the Crescenta Valley in what is now the city of Glendale. There are 15 buildings and one structure, 10 residential, one communal.
We can't hear. I'm sorry.
Oh, but I used it earlier and there was no problem. Of these 15 buildings and one structure, 14 buildings in the structure are contributors to the historic district. The buildings are set within a lushly landscaped garden with mature oak and other trees and a variety of ornamental garden objects. The landscape is an integral component of Rockhaven and a significant part of its original design. The landscape and its associated features are identified as a contributing site within the historic district. Rockhaven's design was inspired by the principles of the cottage plan for mental institutions, first developed in the late 19th century. The cottage plan placed numerous individual buildings within landscaped gardens in order to create a serene, home-like environment for residents. It also reflects the theory of environmental determinism for mental health facilities, the idea that the environment, including architecture and landscaping, shapes behavior. The district overall retains a high degree of integrity and reflects its significance as an early 20th century mental institution. The non-contributing building, constructed in 1971, is one story in height and designed to be compatible with the historic buildings. The district retains all aspects of integrity. Rockhaven Sanitarium is eligible for the National Register at the state level of significance under Criterion A in the area of social history, as one of the best extant examples of an early 20th century woman-owned, women-serving private sanitarium in the state. It was one of the first of its type in the nation. It reflects the vision of Agnes Richards, registered nurse, and represents a small but significant movement that sought to improve the conditions of mentally ill women in the early 20th century. Rather than housing women in large public institutions under deplorable conditions, smaller, privately run home-like facilities were created by women exclusively for women. In California, Rockhaven Sanitarium is one of three remaining women's mental health facilities from the period. The period of significance is 1923, reflecting the date Rockhaven was first established by Agnes Richards, through 1967, when Richards, who was the visionary and driving force behind Rockhaven's philosophy and development, died. Rockhaven Sanitarium remained associated with founder Agnes Richards until her death in 1967. The district reflects exceptional importance due to the rarity of extant resources associated with early 20th century mental health care, its significance as a woman-owned facility established to care for mentally ill women, its continued association with women's health care throughout the life of the institution, and its long association with Richards, who continued to be actively involved at Rockhaven until shortly before her death in 1967. Therefore, the district meets criteria consideration G for properties that have achieved significance within the past 50 years. The property is nominated on behalf of Friends of Rockhaven, a nonprofit organization. The Historic Preservation Commission, in its role as representative of the City of Glendale, a certified local government, received a copy of the nomination. The city, as owner, objects to the nomination and a notarized letter is on file. Letters of support were received from the Glendale Historical Society and Los Angeles Conservancy. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that Rockhaven Sanitarium Historic District meets National Register Criterion A at the state level of significance with a period of significance 1923 to 1967 and satisfies criteria consideration G. Staff recommends the State Historic Preservation Officer approve the nomination for forwarding to the National Park Service for listing on the National Register.
Thank you. So I've got three cards, all in support. Is that really loud?
No.
Again, is there anybody that is here to speak in opposition? Okay. So then the three that would like to speak in support, I've got Emily, I can't read the last name, Lonergan, and Christine Lazaretto, and Michael Morgan. Again, if you would like to come up and... If you could just state your name.
Good afternoon, Chair and Commissioners. I'm Christine Lazaretto with Historic Resources Group. Our firm assisted the Friends of Rockhaven in the preparation of the nomination, so I'm going to defer our time to them today. But I did want to say thank you to Amy Crane for all of her help in preparing the nomination and for her presentation today, which I think does an excellent job of conveying how important this site is and its unique place in California history. It really is a special and important place, and we feel strongly that it's eligible for listing in the National Register. I know you have seen the letter from the City of Glendale, so I just wanted to say that they don't actually dispute that it's eligible and that it meets the criteria for listing. So I don't think that there's been any debate about whether or not the site merits designation. So I would also just like to ask for your support in listing Rockhaven in the National Register of Historic Places. And with that, I will defer to my colleagues from the Friends of Rockhaven. But I am here to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Emily Lanigan, and can you hear me?
Okay.
It's turned up all the way. Is that a little bit better? Okay. I'm Emily Lanigan, and I sit on the board of Friends of Rockhaven. Rockhaven Sanitarium resides in the Crescenta Valley, and I am a fifth-generation resident of the Crescenta Valley. It's very significant to our local history, to Southern California history, to women's history, and to the history of mental health, and how our views of mental health have changed over the last century, mostly for the better. Agnes Richards, who started Rockhaven in 1923, came from an environment of atrocious, overcrowded insane asylums and wanted to create a place that was graceful, where women could be treated with dignity. And what she started stands in absolutely beautiful example today. I'm here representing not just myself, but the Friends of Rockhaven, our several of our board members who are here, as well as Agnes's granddaughter, Sister Mary Peter, who is with us. And we just ask for your support in continuing to advocate for Rockhaven Sanitarium. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, Commissioners, and staff. My name is Michael Morgan. I've been a resident of Glendale since 1955, where Rockhaven is located. Though I am a Historic Preservation Commissioner for the City of Glendale, I'm speaking as an individual, and I am on the Rockhaven Board. I would like to state Historical Resources Commission to recognize how important Rockhaven is, both for women's history and the fact that the grounds as of today retain a high degree of integrity. I helped the city back in 2008 envision and purchase this unique property, and I just want you to see the original thing when the city bought it, and also the report that the city put on for Rock Haven itself, which basically says exactly what has been said today. I invite you to walk the grounds, and you will see, as we do, how important Rock Haven is. And I would like you to please support this nomination on its merit. Thank you very much.
So this is always a little unusual when there's only the proponents, but you do have another 16 minutes if you'd like to speak. If not, then you can use your five-minute rebuttal.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Thank you so very much for considering this. I want to make sure that I'm close to the microphone.
Just state your name, too.
My name is Joanna Lindhorst. I am a founding member and president of the Friends of Rock Haven. The very first day that I was able to walk on this property, having grown up in the Crescenta Valley and knowing that this place was here, I didn't want to leave. My heart got left behind because of the beauty of the architecture and the beauty of the things that went on there. And I have managed to meet many people whose parents worked there, whose mothers stayed there, and the effect that it had on them and their families. And there are buildings there that maintain the entirety of the interior of their buildings. A particular 1931 building is in my mind with the tiles and the various things. It is a very remarkable spot, and we appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, then we will close. Do you want to use your five-minute rebuttal? You have it? Okay. Okay. So we will then close the comments. And now, commissioners, would you like to start a discussion, or do you have any questions for the staff? Your mic is still not working. But all those are commissioners. Any other questions?
Okay. No, I think this one works. Yeah. Yes, I would like to move. I don't think there's any other comment or against, and therefore I would like to move the nomination as it is written.
Second. So Marshall seconds. It's a roll call vote. Alberto?
Aye.
Adrian?
Aye.
Beth? Aye.
Marshall? Aye.
Rick? Aye.
And Brian? Aye as well. So that's motion carries. Would any of you guys like to come up and any other further comments?
Emily Lanigan, I want to thank you very much for your consideration. Rock Haven is a place that sits very, very close to our hearts. It was the subject of an Emmy Award-winning documentary in 2009. It's the subject of two books being written right now, as well as many articles in the Huffington Post and the Los Angeles Times. And we thank you so much for your time and your consideration and recognizing its significance.
Thank you. Great, thank you. So, staff, if you want to move to the next one, your choice.
Ready, sir.
Willow Glen Trestle is a 210-foot open-deck pile-supported trestle, approximately 25 feet tall at its highest point, spanning Los Gatos Creek in the neighborhood of Willow Glen, San Jose. Constructed by Western Pacific Railroad in 1922, the trestle was intended to carry Western Pacific trains to a growing industrial district of San Jose without undue disruption of the existing Willow Glen community. The trestle is eligible under Criterion A for its association with the industrial development of San Jose. Until the arrival of Western Pacific Railroad, San Jose and its surrounding agricultural communities had only one choice for railroad access to their community, Southern Pacific, whose near monopoly on freight traffic allowed them to dictate high rates to shippers. By encouraging Western Pacific to enter the San Jose area, the two railroads were placed in competition, and Western Pacific gained access to a major regional shipper of agricultural produce. There were obstacles to Western Pacific's entry into the area, including concerns of neighbors and communities along the proposed alignment, and resistance by Southern Pacific Railroad, who felt it was in their interest to maintain their transportation monopoly. Completion of the trestle allowed access to a large industrial district, resulting in creation of a distinct branch of Western Pacific's operation in the San Jose area, the Willow Glen Branch. This branch included multiple commercial spurs, serving approximately 20 to 30 shippers, passing tracks, and two interlockings where Western Pacific tracks cross Southern Pacific right-of-way. The property retains most aspects of integrity, with some loss of integrity of design, materials, and feeling due to removal of rails and tie plates, and addition of a deck safety rail, but the property retains sufficient overall historic integrity to remain eligible under Criterion A, with all timber elements of the superstructure still extant. The nomination was prepared by a third party. The property owner, the City of San Jose, opposes the nomination. The nomination has received 36 letters of support, including a finding by the City of San Jose Preservation Commission that the property was eligible for local listing, and 8 letters opposing listing, including multiple letters and documents received from the City of San Jose, which includes a historic assessment from a project EIR that determined the trestle was not eligible for listing in the National Register. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends that the State Historical Resources Commission determine that the Willow Glen Trestle is eligible for listing in the National Register under Criterion A at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1922 to 1965. Staff recommends the State Historic Preservation Officer approve the nomination for forwarding to the National Park Service for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. That completes my report.
Thank you. So I'm not going to repeat everything, but I'm just going to emphasize again that each side has 20 minutes. I have 11 cards in support. It's going to be tremendous time management for that side. So each side has 20 minutes. You're going to need to allocate yourselves. Then each side will again have 5 minutes, okay? And I do want to remind you guys that really not so applicable in this one, but we're only looking at the applicable register criteria, not any social or economic matters related to the nomination or nomination property. So we'll start with the proponents. Again, 20 minutes. You please allocate yourselves. State your name when you begin to speak.
SHPO and Council for the Department, it's a pleasure to speak before you. I'm Susan Brandt Hawley of the Brandt Hawley Law Group, and here on behalf of the Friends of the Willow Glen Trestle. I will leave the specifics of the nomination, of course, to people who know the most about it. I just wanted to mention that, as often happens before this commission, the impetus for opposition to the nomination is the city's desire for demolition. And that is not relevant to what's before you, so we are not going to address the EIR process, the CEQA issues, or the city's plans for demolition, because we know, as the chair has mentioned, that the only issues before you are the qualifications for nomination. And I also became aware just today that there is a contention that this commission's action is, in fact, a CEQA action. It's identification of historic status. And this occasionally comes around every number of years as a question, but in fact, there is no CEQA problem with this commission considering the eligibility of the Willow Glen Trestle. Thank you. And Larry Ames, the head of the Friends, will speak next.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Larry Ames. We are third-party nomination, the Friends of the Willow Glen Trestle. We're not really historians. I'm an aerospace engineer. But we all live in the area there, and we're all interested in preserving some of our local history. We want this to be a place-making feature for our neighborhood. San Jose is more than just a sea of suburbia. It does have some older neighborhoods with a variety of different houses, residential neighborhoods, commercial streets. We helped 30 years ago save the house on the right by having it declared a city landmark. We've been working on a variety of creeks and trails in the area here, two creek trails along the Los Gatos Creek, the Los Guadalupe Coyote, and then also the Three Creeks Trail. This trestle is at the intersection of the railroad, the trail on the Three Creeks Trail where it crosses the Los Gatos Creek. It's at the Red Star there. Just to show the level of community support, I want to very quickly show the Green Star there. We did a community-based project where we did an urban stream restoration project where we turned barren ground through a lot of community involvement into a large open park, 10-acre park, restored habitat. And in the process, we changed state laws, energized the entire community, and made the whole area aware of the creeks. And I think this project here is doing the same thing. We're making the neighborhoods now aware of the history, the agricultural past, and the importance of saving things. It also got me some more work to do, so those are my credentials. So anyhow, talking about the railroad itself, when we moved to San Jose in 1979, it was still an agricultural area. There were truckloads of tomatoes that were going off to the canneries. And the trestle there, pictured it 30 years ago, looks just like it does now. But the city recognized that the area was changing, the railroad was going to go away because the canneries were leaving. And so in 2000, they came up with this green print for recognizing it as a trail right-of-way. We in the community had to remind the city of that when they first considered selling off the land for residential development, but through a decade-long process, half the right-of-way is now in city ownership. We need to get the other half bought. We in the community helped the city get some funding. We gave presentations to different groups. I gave a presentation to State Senator Jim Bell, and part of the presentation featured the historic connections here, because this trail connects the History Museum at Kelly Park over the historic trestle to the housing area that is still where the cannery was, where they still have remnants of the cannery, the water tower, for example. It's the historic connections. And then 3 years ago, the city rather abruptly decided to change plans, so we in the community worked to raise the awareness of the public about this thing. We wrote guest editorials in the newspaper. We got 3 major editorials in the main paper of San Jose in support of the trestle. We gave tours of the public, a lot of public interest in it, so the public came out to see this thing. This trestle is accessible, but it's kind of hidden, so knowing where, getting a tour helped 100 people know where this place is. We gave presentations before neighborhood community meetings. Interesting thing, the Historic Landmarks Commission has a photo contest, so I entered a picture of it 2 years ago. Came in finalist. The following year, 3 of the 7 finalists were pictures of this. The public became aware of it. It's got their attention, and they're interested in preserving this piece of history now. In fact, it was such a big issue that it was the lead story in the year in review. Now, despite all this efforts, the city was just going ahead with its plans to demolish it, so we had to sue the city to have them do an environmental impact report. That's not a topic here, but it does say the trestle is strong, can easily be repaired, it doesn't impede the stream, and it doesn't hurt anything. Then we also brought it to the city's Historic Landmarks Commission. Had a standing room only meeting there. Very strong support, and the commission unanimously recommended that it be granted city historic landmark status. But then the council decided to override it and declare that it was not historic. And then the following month, the mayor gives me a present an award saying it is historic again. So I'm not sure quite what to think. But anyhow, the trestle is still there. It's still standing. It's in limbo. Everything is sitting there right now for this past year. And so with your recognition, we might be able to save this thing. We're hoping it'll be a connection between the Silicon Valley of today and the agricultural past, the Valley of the Hearts of Life. Thank you. Next, I want to invite Seth Bergstein to talk.
Good afternoon, members of the Commission, State Historic Preservation Officer. My name is Seth Bergstein. I'm principal and owner of PAST Consultants, a certified architectural historian throughout California. I want to try to lay out some of how we derive the association here for this, because it's really quite interesting. If we take ourselves And I'm going to talk more than show a lot of images here. If we take ourselves to around just before World War I, the city of San Jose is in a very interesting position. The 4th Street Railroad alignment, which Southern Pacific Railroad occupied, was causing a major traffic nightmare throughout town. A lot of editorials and newspapers, a lot of concerns. The city of San Jose was also quite concerned that Southern Pacific had a freight monopoly. Essentially, all freight traffic was controlled by the Southern Pacific Railroad at this time. The city of San Jose saw a fairly disadvantageous position at this time, and they decided not to grant the Southern Pacific its next franchise to run railroad through the city, which expired in 1918. What this enabled them to do is to delay this decision and then sort of create leverage so that the Southern Pacific would have some kind of competition and they could hopefully get the 4th Street alignment moved. So what did they do? Well, in 1913, they came in and they invited members of the Western Pacific Railroad, which actually was developed out of the Denver and Rio Grande that you see right here in this image here. And essentially what the Western Pacific was trying to do at this time was to make a decision on whether they were going to take charge of some of the freight in the area. A leader of that of the movement was T.S. Montgomery, who was actually a board member of the Western Pacific Railroad, and also, as San Jose residents know, one of the leading financiers of the region. There are several large extant buildings attributed to Montgomery, including the Toohey Building, the Montgomery Hotel. He essentially was, for lack of a better term, a railroad baron, only for the Western Pacific Railroad. Rather than the Big Four, Montgomery was fairly smart. He had already controlled all of the land around Willow Glen by owning one realty company, the Standard Realty Company. They had all exclusive rights to property around the Western Pacific alignment. So what Montgomery and the board decided to do upon their invitation was to say they'd take the challenge. They would build a branch line from Niles, which is, of course, near Fremont, and into San Jose, and take San Jose, the city of San Jose, up on its offer. This occurs in the early 1920s. And the trestle is completed as the gateway to the Cannery Rich region of West San Jose. Now, in order for them to do that, what they had to do was essentially construct a very, very large, I'm going to go back to here for a minute. You can see a very large sort of hook-like shape that's circulating around Oakland, comes into San Jose in the west. This was to avoid the Southern Pacific tracks at the time. There was other wrangling going on in that the city was trying to get both railroads to share a Union Station. Montgomery and the board was actually quite smart, knowing that that would reduce their ability to create revenue on the line, and they decided not to do that and continue to be this sort of pawn that the city of San Jose was playing to try to get Southern Pacific to break this monopoly. So at this time, there's an interesting thing going on, and that is local farmers and growers in a very fruit-rich region of San Jose had only one option, Southern Pacific Railroad for competition. And they also could not access Southern Pacific's cars unless they had a large enough volume of product. What the Western Pacific did was essentially serve the little guy. It came in with something called a less-than-carload, or an LCL, which would enable a farmer or a small grower to be able to take advantage of actually getting their fruit shipped and not have to go through the Southern Pacific. This is one way that Western Pacific was able to break into a market that was, remember, very monopolized at the time. So the railroad wars continue. We're approaching World War I. Okay. Now, the war delays any kind of franchises being determined because the government takes over railroads for the war effort. When World War I ends and the railroads are now returned to their respective boards of directors, the city of San Jose decides not to grant Southern Pacific the franchise. Instead, they grant it to the Western Pacific for the sole purpose of getting competition into the region. This now fosters the decision for Western Pacific to construct the line. They do so, and what you're seeing right now before you is a map of essentially what it would look like post 1922, and after the Willow Glen Trestle is constructed. So essentially, what this does is this brings in a lot of competition for the city of San Jose. It fosters development. Now, if you look at our image right here, we have Willow Glen circled in a roughly off-white pattern. We have
We have the Willow Glen Trestle in pink. All your industry to the right of that, which is actually northeast on the map, was essentially constructed as spur tracks to serve industry. And by 1958, although the packing industry is changing in San Jose at the time for suburbanization, there's still essentially a lot of there's a lot of traffic going on here. And what's interesting is every single train has to cross that trestle to get there. There is no other way to do it. So essentially, this is the gateway to a roughly expanded amount of industry. Now, when you look at the stats, you see, you can look at shipping totals, things like this. It's very difficult to determine exactly where and how things were shipped based on very rough stats from various railroad sources. However, it was clear based on just something as simple as apricots and prunes, which are the mainstay of San Jose's economy at this time. Western Pacific, the year they broke in, quadrupled their shipping of that product, dried fruit, in essentially the first year. By the third year, they had gone almost eightfold. And what was more important was that in local newspapers were reading editorials at this time that say, the small shipper is being served. There is greater competition here. Okay, now there's the other association for development here is the fact that Willow Glen remains residential. And there's reasons why this happened. Willow Glen was going over issues about incorporation over fears of the Western Pacific alignment coming into town. And this is going on in editorials throughout the newspapers at this time if one reads them. The first incorporation vote in 1917 did not happen. Largely because Montgomery was quoted in the paper as saying he will absolutely make certain that no industrial construction will occur in Willow Glen. And what then happens beyond this is that when we get into the 1920s, the Southern Pacific is still trying to figure out how they're going to fit in and how they're going to grant a franchise. San Jose continues their negotiations. And they finally get, at the end of the story, Southern Pacific to move their alignment off of 4th Street, relieve this traffic congestion, and essentially doing this by inviting the Western Pacific into the town. And then the sort of the other development, and this is evident throughout Willow Glen today, and you'll certainly see this in your National Register packet, there are photographs of extra resources. If you look at block and lot maps, and there's also copies of them in the nomination, and you check them out, you will see Montgomery Standard Realty Company flanking all of this alignment. And then when you drive these neighborhoods, you see wonderful extant 1920s, 1930s residential neighborhoods that remain exactly as they were constructed. So this evidence of residence is quite there in Willow Glen. And for folks that live there, Willow Glen still retains this kind of leafy, eclectic residential character. And I just want to show you on this map here, difficult to read, but there's a list of about 40-odd clients for the Western Pacific. The other interesting connection is that T.S. Montgomery also owned about and controlled through his own connections to the fruit industry about 80% of product before he builds this railroad. So he's a smart man. He knows how to do it. He knows how to play politics, and he knows how to get things done. And he does keep his promise to keep Willow Glen residential. And I'm going to close on that so we can have others talk. You'll see the arrow in that Willow Glen circle. That is the only industrial spur line in Willow Glen. It was a lumber yard. There was no other industry in Willow Glen. So despite Willow Glen's fears, and to close the story at the very end, Willow Glen does incorporate for a very brief time. And why do they do this? Because they now keep the Southern Pacific out later when they try to get their franchise. Thank you. I want to turn this over to some supporters of the trestle.
So just a reminder of the time, you've got 4.5 minutes.
Yeah, someone can line up behind me. My name's Scott Lane. I grew up in Willow Glen. Very much an amazing structure that's here. To me, a lot of what happens in Silicon Valley actually started here. You know, less than carloads, innovation, making this a very modular bridge, and it still keeps the character to this day. So I think it was the start of amazing things in Silicon Valley, but it kept the amazing residential character of the 1910s and 30s.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I am Martha Heinrichs, a longtime resident of Willow Glen. As a family historian and genealogist, I realize it is through historic preservation that our resources are recognized, appreciated, and protected so that future generations may benefit from them. It is only then when we tell the stories of our ancestors as they relate to a particular historic event and the preserved historic site, that we can really see the true picture of what made us all what we are today. This 94-year-old Willow Glen Trestle is still standing tall and strong and is an important representation of our local history during that era when Santa Clara County was known as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Heather Lerner, also from Willow Glen Neighborhood. You know, these bridges have such a lore for so many of us that can't be replaced by a bridge in a box. It's just metal manufacturing. Of course, so many of our relatives were grandparents that worked in the canneries. We know that some people may not care about that, but for us, it's a direct link to that. I actually got to ride my bike across this trestle yesterday. Well, I wasn't supposed to do that, but I did anyway. So we're big fans of rails to trails. I want to direct your attention to a website called bridgehunter.com, and it actually shows the lore of all these bridges and which ones are still available and which ones are, you know, impending doom and which ones we've lost. So please check out bridgehunter.com. Don't take my word for it. Check it out there to know about that lore of bridges. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Gail Frank, and I'm on the board of Preservation Action Council of San Jose, and we strongly support this nomination of Willow Glen Trestle. And as Larry mentioned, it's been a popular subject for our historic photo contest in San Jose. And last year, three of the winners, the topic was the trestle. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Laura Levin. I'm a community member. I wrote one of the letters of support for listing the Willow Glen Trestle in the National Register of Historic Places. The trestle is an authentic link to Santa Clara County's agricultural heritage as the Valley of Heart's Delight. Thank you for your attention.
My name is Deborah Arendt, and I'm a resident of San Jose. I just came to say that we strongly support the preservation of the trestle, and that it will make a wonderful contribution to show in living history what our valley used to be. Thank you.
Well, I said everything out quickly, but I want to thank you for considering this thing, and we'd like to keep this as a feature for our neighborhood, as a welcoming icon to our neighborhood. Thank you.
Still 41 seconds. Anyone else? you guys have done an amazing job, logistically speaking. Okay, then. Okay.
It's Robert Inmans. I am a native of San Jose. My home is right up against the trestle. Years I admired, saw the value of it, saw it in action, and even rode trains across it thanks to some good crews that let me do that. And I can only wonder what significance that had in the area that I just really embrace and feel very passionate about. And I'm being emotional about it, but I can't help but impart that to you. And thank you, Mr. Berg, for receiving, and staff, for receiving the letters that I sent you with the different organizations that are also in very much in accord with seeing the value and the very structure and what it represents. Thank you very much.
Yep. All right, thank you. So we will now hear from the opponents again, 20 minutes. I do have five cards of individuals that would like to speak. So Twyla, go ahead and start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, staff, commissioners. My name is Martina Davis, and I am serving as the Historic Preservation Officer of the City of San Jose. I'm here as a representative of the city today. The City of San Jose is a certified local government, and we are committed to preservation of historic properties and structures.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Thank you.
Can you hear it better?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So we're, as a certified local government, San Jose is committed to preservation of historic structures. The city has an inventory of over 3,800 historic structures, including 13 historic districts and over 200 individually designated city landmarks. The city has evaluated the trestle for historic significance numerous times over the past decade or so, and each time found that the property is not a historic resource. The city is opposed to this nomination. As part of our various efforts in evaluating the trestle, in 2004, we actually sent a referral to the State Office of Historic Preservation pursuant to Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act. At that time, SHPO determined that the structure is not a historic resource and did not qualify for the National Register. The pending nomination purports that the trestle is significant on the local level. The city has spoken on local significance. After considering public testimony, much of which you've heard today, the opinion of expert staff and expert consultants, as well as the Landmarks Commission's recommendation, the City Council has denied a historic landmark nomination for the trestle. So the trestle is not a local historic landmark. As part of our diligence in evaluating the trestle, we've sought the advice and expertise of Mr. Stephen Meixel, who is a noted expert in evaluation of bridges and trestles. Mr. Meixel has more than 30 years of experience in the historic preservation field. He was for 10 years the Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer and has worked at Caltrans and with several environmental consulting firms. He's also experienced in evaluating historic bridges and railroad properties. He's the author of the book Historic Highway Bridges of California, published in 1990, and has just completed a book on the Sierra Railway, published this year. He's also recently completed a National Register nomination for the I-Straight Bridge in Sacramento and is completing a nomination for Railtown 1897 for state parks. So due to Mr. Meixel's extensive expertise, the city chose him to assist us with our evaluation. So again, I want to reiterate that as a certified local government, San Jose is opposed to this nomination. We do not agree that the trestle is significant on the local level. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Meixel to elaborate on the analysis. Thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Well, thank you, Martina. Just two quick points, because I'm assuming that you did get in your package an extensive report that I wrote. It's going on 2 years ago now. First point was, as shown in the report that you have a copy of, I did evaluate this under National Register Criterion A for its association with the Western Pacific and the development of the fruit packing industry in San Jose. And I acknowledge that, you know, the fruit packing industry obviously was very important to San Jose, and having a second line come in is a valuable addition. I just found that it was kind of a stretch to go from this rather modest trestle to making a case for significant associations with the fruit packing industry. It's not the way that bridges are typically evaluated under Criterion A. All bridges serve a useful function. They get a railroad or a highway from one side of a river to the other side. Having said that, significance is usually something more than that. While I was evaluating, just so happened that at the same time I was evaluating significance for this trestle, I was reevaluating significance for the I Street Bridge in Sacramento, which is a 1911 movable span that carries the trunk line of the Southern Pacific from Oakland to Chicago and carries it over the Sacramento River, which is a major crossing. And as such, the bridge is really quite significant under Criterion C, but under A, because it carries a trunk line over a major crossing and is the oldest example of that. That's the kind of thing that I think Criterion A is that's how you establish Criterion A significance for bridges. And I just, frankly, I couldn't make that leap from this one modest trestle to significance under Criterion A. That's point number one. Point number two, and this is just to say, this shouldn't need to be said, but I'll say it anyway. No one ever asked me to say that this bridge was eligible or not eligible. When the city decided, or well, really was compelled to do an extra study of this bridge when it was ordered to prepare an EIR for the trails project, the judge didn't say that it needed to be found to be eligible for the National Register or the local listing. He just said that it needed to be studied in greater detail, which I did. And the city, you know, called on me to do that because I have quite a bit of experience in dealing with bridges and railroad properties. So I did my due diligence, and no one at the city ever asked me to say it was eligible or not. I wouldn't have taken a job if they hadn't. I did my due diligence. I found that it was not a significant resource in under the National Register or the California Register or even the City of San Jose landmark criteria. So that's it. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Pierluigi Oliverio, council member for the City of San Jose, actually this geographic region of the city for 10 years, resident for 46 years. For the common majority of the residents, they don't even know the structure exists. It sits behind Mr. T's Liquor Locker, which is a liquor store, and it's really not known. Only through the lawsuit did this become an issue, as you saw through the clippings in there, and most of the residents, I would say, were just sort of overwhelmed by why would anyone want to stop a trail from being connected, which has been the case for 2 years. You, in your packet, you have an EIR, which the city spent nearly $500,000 on, and part of that is a historical, and obviously you have Steve here. I really hope the board will ask any questions of the historical expert in the room. As noted, our Landmarks Commission, which has no historical historians on the commission, voted to make it historic while our expert was in the audience, and not a single question for the expert, who is obviously credentialed in many ways. Also in your packet, you have a letter from our mayor, and in that it reiterates much of what Martina said, that the city has already done a great job at historic preservation, whether it be neighborhoods or structures. We have a process. As the local agency, we know the local connections best from the residents growing up in the city. The council has received input on this numerous times, and numerous times it has acted to move forward. We've done as you mentioned by the comments, that we contacted your agency, and your agency said it's not historic. So then we went on to the next level and did the very expensive historical report, and there again, not historic. Local government grapples with structures that are often found to be nostalgic, but are not historic. And there needs to be a process where there's consistency. Otherwise, anyone who is not credentialed can call any structure as historic, and then creating this problem then for local government of litigation and losing money, et cetera. But again, the report is very clear, it's not historic. We agree with the analysis that the Office of Historic Preservation originally gave us, and with the report, the feasibility of rehabbing the trestle is very not positive. And in regards to the actual permitting agencies that would issue us a permit, they don't want the structure in the waterway because it's an abomination of the environment of taking 95 creosote-soaked telephone poles and putting them in the waterway, because that conflicts with the habitat that can happen there. So in any event, this is the affirmation from the historical report, the city council. Thank you for your time. I think we have some other speakers.
Hello, my name is Thaisa McMahon, and I'm the president of the Friends of the Three Creeks Trail, an organization committed to the connection and completion of the trail. The trestle up for consideration today is a significant threat to the trail completion. And you have a group of very passionate, very active people who I have worked with in supporting the trestle and its historic designation, but it is not representative of the actual population of San Jose. A majority of the people want to be able to use this trail, want to be able to walk across it to get to their job, to get to the train station. And although I appreciate their enthusiasm does not equate historic. Affection does not equate historic. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Bruce Titchenham. I'm legal counsel for the Friends of the Three Creeks Trail, Inc., a California nonprofit dedicated to establishing the Three Creeks Trail. The March 23rd letter to this commission from Ms. McMahon, who just spoke, tells you about the importance of that trail. I'm here today to make 2 points. First of all, this proposal to list the trestle presents you, this commission, with a sad choice, perhaps for the first time, right? Perhaps historically, to choose between which of two relics of the past you will preserve and which will you will allow to be destroyed. Now you're all on this commission because of your demonstrated passion for preserving significant relics of the past for the enjoyment of future generations. The first relic is the trestle. It is man-made and lifeless. The second relic is the officially threatened California Central Coast steelhead and the Chinook salmon. They are natural and alive. To me, it's an easy choice. My colleague, legal colleague, Ms. Brand Hawley, said that you have no CEQA problem in considering listing of the trestle. I agree completely with that phrasing. There is no legal problem under CEQA. There is, however, a legal requirement under CEQA. Because this project may have a significant effect on the environment, and it's documented in the San Jose EIR on their pedestrian bridge proposal, the long-term adverse impacts of removing trees that shade the waters and preventing the dispersal of large wood downstream, you will have those two long-term adverse impacts on threatened species of fish. And therefore, you are required under CEQA to prepare an environmental impact report unless you just flat out disapprove both of the listing. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So that was the last speaker card that I have. There's still 7 minutes left. If one of the speakers that already spoke would like to add any additional comments. If not, then we will close it.
I'd certainly like to defer to professional planning staff or our historic expert, but in lieu of them getting up, I'm just going to continue on that. And I'll read from you the letter. In addition, the city evaluated the feasibility of rehabilitating the trestle and concluded that there was not a viable option. If you were to physically examine the trestle, you would see that most of the structure is charred and fire-burned. In San Jose, much like much of the state of California, we have homeless encampments. And the homeless often cook where they sleep, and that is directly underneath this trestle. And this trestle has caught on fire numerous times, and our fire department has documented coming out to extinguish the fire, whether it was accidental or arson. So there's a variety of things that you tackle here, and I know you're supposed to have a narrow focus on historic, but there are other things there, and I'm certainly available for any questions, but I certainly want to make the commission available to anything on our historic or anyone else from the city. Paraluigi Oliverio, member.
Thank you, Tuella.
Eve Zudi, City of San Jose. I manage the trail program for the City of San Jose. San Jose has one of the largest urban trail networks in the country, and we have a very ambitious goal of interconnecting those trails. So people have mentioned the Three Creeks Trail, the trail connectivity. This project is important because it impacts that issue. We developed a project that would clear span the creek and resolve the environmental issue and produce a bridge crossing that can be used 365 days a year. The trestle structure has been subject to fire numerous times. I've walked the structure multiple times, and 2 years ago I decided I'd never walk it again because of the fire damage, the gaps in the structure, and the general deterioration. When we purchased the land, the railroad corridor, it included the trestle, but it also included a mile of property. That land has been cleared. It was cleaned to Department of Toxic Substance Control requirements. There were no conditions about that. We were happy to clean that environment. And we've worked with the community over multiple years to prepare a master plan for this trail, for that connection that leads to downtown San Jose, that we recall the history in that corridor. So we're including water tank structures that educate children in the community about the water tank pressure and supply that used to support this rail line. We have interpretive stations to recall the iris gardens that used to be farmed adjacent to the corridor. And we have canning labels and history about the entire corridor and its surroundings. The trestle is, again, a wonderful nostalgic structure for people to recall. but I can tell you personally and not as a city staff person, I grew up in Willow Glen. My parents have lived in Willow Glen since 1961, and when I have dinner with them, they say, where is that trestle? No one, from their perspective, they don't even know where it is. So that concludes my comments.
If I could just ask you to fill out a speaker card.
Which is, I see people looking at this picture. That is not the trestle that we're talking about today. Just so you know, that's not an accurate photograph of the trestle right there. Just so you know, that's not what it looks like.
Yeah. Anybody else from the opponents? 3.5 minutes? If not, we'll close. Okay. Twyla, if you can reset the clock. So again, now 5 minutes for the proponents as a rebuttal.
Yeah, that is the trestle on the left. On the right is a little bridge just showing how we can do the railing that is a new bridge. The trestle's on the left. Yes. So I want to thank you also again, and we'd like to keep the real thing rather than just have some plaques and diagrams for what's in the past. I'd like to introduce Wayne Donaldson to the panel.
My name is Milford Wayne Donaldson. I'm Chair Brandis, members of the State Historical Resources Commission, Secretary Polanco in your position today, but as SHPO, and Council Lynch. I'd like to remind you, I'm going to just burn maybe 5 seconds here. So 11 years ago, the commission met in this very room to listen to over 400 people, chairs all the way to the wall and standing room only, on two large Palo Alto districts being nominated. And it was all about community, and that's what I want to address today is community. The 1966 National Historic Preservation Act, which created your commission, celebrating its 50th years, the purpose of the act says, the historical and cultural foundation of the nation should be preserved as a living part of our community, life, and development in order to give us a sense of orientation to the American people. That is the purpose of the act. I'd also like to remind you all that this is under criteria A, which is associated with industrial and economic development of the San Jose community, not C. And as all of you know, these linear resources, whether they be bridges or railroads or old highways or airports or transmission lines or water resources or trails, are always difficult because they change over time. We know they change over time. But more importantly, the San Jose Preservation Commission voted unanimously. There was one person that was absent. And I listened to the audio tape of the commission. And Commissioner Marilyn Messina said, I think it's wonderful to see a group of people and so passionate and dedicated about preserving something, something unique, and special in your area and the history. And it's very gratifying to see that. But more important, the chair, Romero Torres, said, even if it only lasts 50 years, he's referring to a report in the EIR, I should think it should not be up at this point, our generation, to make that determination that it should be torn down. I have a 2.5-year-old, and maybe then, 50 years from now, his generation can say yes to rebuilding the structure. Or if it's too old, maybe replaced. But at this point, if we're going to last another 50 years, let's keep it. So I think it's important when we're looking at these is that there's a need for every generation and every community to discover these pieces of lost gold, as William has always said, is that in the beginning of the National Historic Preservation Act, we had a lot of placer gold we could just pick up off the ground. But now we have to look for these special things, like mid-century modern, and how we keep these going. So when we're looking at Willow Glen, I think it will give us, again, another sense of this orientation to community to establish not just what was that time, Western San Jose, but to all of the members of San Jose. Also, I think it's important that we can all benefit from saving these structures. There's an economic value that's still there. There's a time to tell the history that relates to other points. So in closing, I'd just like to say a few items. If you want to talk about the 2004 letter, I'm available to do that, because in all due respect, the city council member is totally confused on that letter that I wrote in 2004. The steelhead have been living a long time, over 100 years in that stream, and in fact the ERA says to leave the bridge alone, and I recommend that the city of San Jose take care of their homeless. So in closing, I highly recommend that we follow the staff's excellent report and that you direct the State Historic Preservation Officer to forward this nomination onto the keeper for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Twyla, if you will reset the clock. So 5 minutes now for the opponents as a rebuttal.
Came here today, I'm just going to be dueling ex-shippos and deputy shippos on the same issue that I don't think either one of us are from San Jose. I guess what my rebuttal, I don't really feel like I need to. I have nothing but the highest praise for Wayne Donaldson and all of the people who are on this staff and from the people in San Jose. I guess I would only ask you to consider the difference between sentiment and history, and the difference between, I guess I'm sort of an old, the difference between applying nostalgia and applying the National Register criteria. I'm sort of old school, I guess. I go back, first job I had outside of, when I got out of grad school was on the National Register staff, as these guys are here, and spent a lot of time trying to learn how you did apply the criteria for listing in the National Register, and I continue to believe that it's important that you do that. I continue to believe that there needs to be thoughtful evaluation, thoughtful analysis of what separates one example of a resource type and the others. And I have spent a career doing exactly that, and almost all of that career evaluating bridges. And I'm just going to repeat an earlier thought, which is that bridges are inherently interesting and useful resources, but the logical extension of that is that you list every bridge. And you need, but if you're not prepared to list every bridge, and I don't think you should, because that makes a mockery of the whole sense of significance. And if you are going to apply some method for separating the wheat from the chaff, the important from the unimportant, I suggest that what you should be applying is a National Register criteria for evaluation, which is your basic charge as being a member of this commission. I continue to believe that if you do rigorously apply those criteria for evaluation, you wouldn't list this bridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, again, Bruce Kitchen, legal counsel for the Friends of the Three Creeks Trail. The gentleman who spoke before the last one, I'm sorry, if I understood him correctly, said that the EIR said to leave the bridge alone, meaning I think the trestle alone. Assuming that I got that much right, I would like to point out that, number one, I read the EIR and I saw no such statement in it. Number two, such a statement would have been completely at odds with the finding in the environmental impact report that the trestle constitutes a long-term adverse impact on the steelhead and the Chinook salmon. And number three, the way for the gentleman to approve that the ER said that will be for him to have done what I did, which had as an exhibit to his statement the excerpt from the EIR that makes that statement. Thank you.
Thank you again for your time and attention. The big question down again for local governments or any governments trying to figure out which structures truly are historic. And if we do things by nostalgia and we don't follow a process, then that's problematic. So why would we then have historians? Why would we have historical reports? I think we need to treat things equally and have a process. And in this case, we went through a process. We had a very knowledgeable historian produce a report, which then the elected body certified. There was no challenge to the report. Through the EIR and CEQA process, any individual can challenge the report, but they didn't because it's solid and it was enough to act. And my guess is it wasn't challenged because there's no money to make off of it because it's claiming legalities or all that. But this, the candid, you know, we've done the EIR, we've done the historic. So again, thank you for your time. And claiming this item to be historic may just leave it there. It crumbles, burns down, because issuing agencies may never issue a permit to have it on a waterway. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Thank you all too. Thank you all for your time management. Well done. So now it's closed from the public side. We will turn it over to the commission. Okay, so actually, Tara will introduce or address the CEQA issue.
Thank you, Chair Brandis and members of the Commission. Shortly after the meeting started, Mr. Tenenchin, who is the counsel for the Friends of the Trail, handed me a letter, and essentially, as he stated in his testimony, his letter is that this commission cannot act on making a determination that the bridge is historic without complying with CEQA. And there's no cases on this at all. And the definition of a project under CEQA is an activity by a public agency or a private activity which must receive some discretionary approval by a government entity which has the potential for a direct physical change or reasonably foreseeable indirect physical change to the environment. As you know, this commission reviews whether or not a property meets the National Register criteria for approval. And there's no case law to rely on, but it's my opinion that that would not result, the commission's determination does not result in a direct physical change in the environment. You could determine the property eligible or not eligible, whatever you wish, but that's not going to be the cause for the change in the environment. As you know, you could still approve something for the National Register, and it could still, at the end of the day, be demolished. Or you could say something is not historic and it could be saved. I mean, your decision is what I'm saying is not equal to a direct or indirect physical change on the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Great, thank you. And now before I turn it over to the commissioners, I want to remind the commissioners as well, we're only here to look at the applicable criteria and not, you know, the social or economic determination or other factors. So are there any commissioners that would like to start a discussion?
Yes. Yeah, sorry that doesn't work. Is there any chance to get a short reading of criteria A so we make it public? Criteria A.
Oh, a short summary of criteria A. William, would you like to do that?
Properties can be eligible for the National Register if they are associated with events that have made a significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history.
Black patterns of our history.
thank you for all the testimony. I was particularly interested in the additional historic evidence that was provided under Criterion A during public comment. And I'm very impressed with the local community's ability to continue to add to the historic report. I also think that the nomination should pass under Criterion A. If it was under Criterion C, I think many of these arguments were addressing the viability of the resource under C, and it wasn't. It was listed under A. So I think it's been evidenced, and I think it's been further evidenced by the public comment. Also, the two factors that really stood out for me was the additional input of the economic history and the additional connection between the bridge and the residential which is an important factor under Criterion A. And then, as an I also wanted to recognize the comment that Wayne Donaldson made at the very beginning, which is to discuss the importance of historic resources being defined within their communities. And I do not feel that what was presented today was nostalgia. I think there was a lot of credible evidence here to show that this is, in fact, a piece of history. And I will remind the commissioners that what they do with the bridge is up to the local jurisdiction. How they integrate the bridge and work with the environment, I know we're all very concerned about that, is up to the local community. But in terms of whether or not this nomination was credible under Criterion A, I believe that it was.
This one's working, right?
Stand up and shout, right?
Hello.
Not that much.
Jeez.
Not that much.
All right, that's maybe a little excessive, yeah. Well, you know, I'm merely an archaeologist here, so I don't show that I really count. But I have some understanding of the National Register criteria. I just to be perfectly honest, when you have someone of Steve Michael's eminence telling you that Criterion A doesn't apply, that goes a long way for me. And I wonder if you could, is it okay to bring him back up? Is it okay to bring Steve back up?
Yeah, I mean, you can go ahead and address the question.
Okay. Well, perhaps, you know, the whole business here is whether the resource meets significance under Criterion A. And I wondered, the staff nomination makes a strong case, right, or makes a case. Don't like to put you on the spot, but I just put you on the spot. Could you tell us why don't you actually think that was, that really works? I mean, you had addressed that in your previous remarks, but maybe kind of.
Asking me to this is a couple of years old, but that's fine. I mean, I did write it, and I remember it pretty well. The objection I have under DNA is finding the relationship between this modest trestle and the development of the fruit packing industry in San Jose. That if you were looking for some resource that would commemorate either, I think I would be looking for a fruit packing shed somewhere in San Jose, or I think I would be looking for a depot or some freight shed that was used by the Western Pacific that actually is directly and significantly associated with the development that we're talking about. I found and continue to believe that the relationship between this trestle and the fruit packing industry in San Jose is pretty tangential, pretty weak. It's a reach for me to make that connection.
I think that the presentation of the proponents, I can't remember your name. Seth Bernstein, and the initial gentleman who spoke, did make very strong arguments exactly for this connection. And I also, I am an architecture historian and have studied a number of bridges and connections. And I do think that connection, the story also having to do with the residential part, is very important, especially when you're opening up a bridge and creating connectivity. You see a lot of these arguments for very significant bridges, but this is one that happens at a smaller scale and at a local level. But I seem to think that today's public presentation really added to the story. And finally, the evaluation of cultural landscapes is relatively new in terms of historic preservation. And this, as a piece of a larger landscape, has a lot of significance. And we are not dealing with the demolition, but to be able to have that piece as part of this local landscape history, I think is a valuable reason to have it placed on the National Register under Criterion A.
We're good. Marshall, did you end up having, do you want to comment?
Well, I'd like to comment. I think it does fit under Criterion A.
Rick, any comments for you?
Well, in trying to decide on the broad significance of the criteria level. Level of significance in criteria A, and I know the argument was made that it's hard to determine whether this trestle really impacted the history of the fruit packing industry or vegetables or whatever around the San Jose area, which may have some truth and validity to it. But I was thinking, well, for the trestle to have been built and to generate the kinds of business decisions around the development of the railroad industry itself in around San Jose. So it was just some kind of social impact that was important. And one of the reasons why the trestle was built was to stimulate commerce and competition. So that says, yes, generally speaking, it did have an impact, and a social impact that's significant. And I'm also thinking, well, is this little trestle, is it not historically significant but still eligible? I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but I was thinking about that. It's either that or it is historically significant and eligible. Right now, if I were to rule on this, I would say, yeah, it is definitely eligible for listing on the register and leave it at that without taking into account all the other mitigating factors and the arguments that were presented and well presented by both sides. It's difficult, but if I were to cast a vote now, it would be for yes. I think it is eligible for listing.
So a couple of comments. These are the ones that are really interesting to me, because you know, as I do represent the public, I don't have a you know, an architectural, you know, history or you know, a really okay a discipline like the rest of them. But and this is even more difficult. When I started, every other word. When I started, I had Wayne as the SHPO, and I had Steve as the executive director, the SHPO. Is that the right? Deputy SHPO. So to me, this is like two professors, you know, building my education in the in this you know, or in this knowledge. And so going through, of course, yes, we go through and read, you know, all the information given to us at the beginning, and you try to formulate where you would make a decision. And honestly, I went back and forth, and I really listened to the comment about the nostalgia, and then also to Steve's comments about and I'm not sure if you all caught it, but he did read or did write, was an author of the historic bridges of the state. And I'm questioning myself, okay, why wasn't that in that? But for the context of that book, and maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the context of that book, that was in the state level. So it's probably not significant on the state level. But Criterion A is a local level. So to me, I'm definitely, went back and forth, and I definitely believe it's a significant, to the local level, and I mean that's, definitely the way I vote, without revealing how I'm going to vote. But anyhow, so to me this is interesting, and unless there's any other commissioner comments, I think we were probably ready for a motion. Who's got a microphone that works?
A few words of my opinion on this issue. There are several things. Number one, I was not born here. I was born abroad. Therefore, for me to have nostalgia for an object like a bridge, I cannot say that. I don't live there either, so I didn't hear about the bridge until today. But I do remember, and I still practice in my profession, the idea or the concept that it brought me to this entity here. And I keep reading the title of our commission, Office of Historic Preservation, for the state of California. And so now I think about the bridge, the object, and I start to see all kind of connections. Timber construction was very important at the turn of the century. Well, it happens to be in a state where timber is plentiful, and particularly at the beginning of the 20th century. And from that point of view, it has the significance that in a very, very, very low means, if we compare to other parts of the world, at that moment everybody was doing concrete bridges, right? But here in a very small, modest community, they decided to use the material that is local. Timber is here, is in California. And timber construction, we can find it throughout, everywhere. So from that point of view, I feel, and from the point of view in sitting in this commission, I feel that it is extremely important that we can protect the few pieces that here and there, they are hidden everywhere, that we should try to keep them up in the eye of everyone and in the for future admiration and observation and studies and learnings of the next generation, the children in the school and in the schools of architecture, the students. To find structural systems in architecture is always a struggle. There's a marriage between the two, between the architecture expression of the building and the structure that allow us to do a room of this nature. When we look at this object or subject of discussion, the connection between the structural system, which is really fascinating, and the final product, it has a visual enhancement, a visual presence, that it becomes, to a certain degree, very unique. And from that point of view, I think it wholly qualifies and put our effort to try to preserve it as much as we can. So I will suggest to my colleague commissioners to give a serious thought to the idea of preserving this subject. Thank you.
Make that into a motion.
Yes, I would like to make a motion to accept and approve the nomination as it has been written.
A second?
I'll second. Beth Harris.
So for a roll call vote, Alberto?
Aye.
Adrian?
Adrian, aye.
Beth?
Aye.
Marshall?
Aye.
Britt? And Brian, aye as well. So the motion carries unanimously. So before we move on, are there any... You just spent quite a bit of time speaking in favor and against. Any additional comments? Need a break? Are we good? Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. This is good. Okay, we're going to move on to the next one. Staff?
View Park Historic District is a residential subdivision located in unincorporated Los Angeles County, consisting of 1,478 contributing buildings, 306 non-contributing buildings, one contributing site, and four non-contributing sites on approximately 450 acres. The buildings of the district are designed in styles including American Colonial Revival, Tudor Revival, Spanish Colonial Revival, French Renaissance, Ranch, Streamline Modern, International Style, and Minimal Traditional. A complex pattern of curvilinear streets indicates the influence of garden suburb design, platted and built out during the period of Los Angeles County's transition from a region of streetcar suburbs to neighborhoods dominated by the automobile. The property is eligible under Criterion A for its roles in community planning and development and African American history. The period of significance, 1923 to 1965, indicates the period from the first phases of suburb development by the Los Angeles Investment Company through the period when the neighborhood transitioned from a racially exclusive suburb to a neighborhood primarily occupied by middle-class and wealthy African Americans. In the context of community planning and development, View Park was one of the largest and most significant suburban development projects of the Los Angeles Investment Company, an important player in the Los Angeles real estate development industry in the mid-20th century, whose practices greatly influenced the local housing market and landscape throughout the region. Because of the large size and comparatively remote location of View Park, full build-out of the neighborhood took more than four decades, beginning in 1923 and ending in 1958. In addition to the residential properties in the district, View Park includes one significant site, Monteith Park, advertised in company marketing materials as a neighborhood amenity. In the context of African American heritage, this neighborhood initially carried racial exclusion covenants that prohibited sale of lands to anyone not of the Caucasian race. These covenants were one of several mechanisms used throughout the United States to limit sales of suburban properties to non-whites. These covenants were later found unconstitutional, but treated as a de facto form of segregation in California long after Supreme Court cases had theoretically prevented their use. Defying these efforts, African-American families began moving into View Park in the late 1950s, facing hostility, threats, and even burning crosses on lawns. In response, the Los Angeles NAACP Housing Committee launched an initiative to make it safe for African-American families to purchase homes in View Park. These families were predominantly middle class and wealthy, with the result that, unlike other neighborhoods that transitioned from exclusively white to African-American residents, View Park retained a high average family income and high property values, earning View Park the nickname the Black Beverly Hills, whose residents included African-American celebrities including Ike and Tina Turner and Ray Charles. The nomination was submitted by the View Park Conservancy on behalf of many of the property owners. The nomination has received 67 letters of support and 12 letters of objection, including 6 formal notarized letters of objection, representing 1/3 of 1% of property owners. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends that the State Historical Resources Commission determine that the View Park Historic District is eligible for listing in the National Register under Criterion A at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1923 to 1965. Staff recommends the State Historic Preservation Officer approve the nomination for forwarding to the National Park Service for listing in the National Register of Historic Places.
Thank you. So I've got I've got 7 cards for speakers, all in support. Were there any speakers in opposition? No? Okay. So, again, you have 20 minutes. Divide your time up accordingly. And Twyla, you go ahead and start the clock.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? My name is Andre Gaines. I'm the co-founder of View Park Conservancy and also a resident of View Park. View Park is located in the unincorporated area of Los Angeles County. It's about 9 miles southwest of downtown Los Angeles. It has an incredible history, and for many years, the residents have shared this proud history with all of the new residents, such as myself, but none of this incredible history had ever been archived. Presently, the neighborhood is changing, and in 2013, a series of major developments were approved within 1/4 mile of View Park, as you can see here on this slide. This represents about $2.4 billion worth of development that is right around our neighborhood. And out of this, View Park Conservancy was born. A volunteer committee of 9 residents formed View Park Conservancy to explore how to best preserve and officially archive the history of the neighborhood for years to come. Several of our members are here today. We were put in contact with the USC Heritage Conservation Department, who volunteered a class to complete a 6-month case study to determine if View Park might be eligible for the National Register. And here are a few photos of the students actually doing the survey, doing the case study in the neighborhood. On May 12th of 2014, the USC presented their findings to an audience of over 60 View Park residents. The results were astonishing, and the information presented managed to surprise residents who have lived in View Park for more than 50 years. And our fundraising efforts had begun. And to complete our nomination, we chose to hire Architectural Resources Group to finish what USC had started. And it was decided that the best way to inform all residents of the initiative and to raise the funds needed to launch a community-wide fundraising effort and to unify View Park around the amazing history of the neighborhood. The request that we made to all of the residents was very simple. It was a one-time $150 contribution per household with the goal of raising $100,000 overall to conduct the surveys that we needed. And on June of 2014, our first of 7 community-wide mailers arrived at 1,789 homes in the View Park Historic District. And internally, the board members, 9 of us of View Park Conservancy, all of whom had donated to the organization ourselves, agreed that if we did not raise at least $5,000 in the first 60 days of our campaign, and it was clear to us that the neighborhood did not want to proceed with this. And to our astonishment, within the first week, View Park residents donated over $10,000. In addition to the traditional mail and email campaigns that we conducted, View Park Conservancy attended and hosted over 25 separate neighborhood community meetings, representing a 45-minute PowerPoint presentation on the facts, data, and processes of listing View Park on the National Register of Historic Places. And this is a photo of one of our community meetings, one of our many community meetings. These meetings were held in homes all across the neighborhood, section by section, and it was done to answer all questions that residents had on a face-to-face basis. Sometimes these meetings were large, with over 70 residents in attendance, and in other cases, these meetings were small, with less than 10 residents in attendance. And this was done on a 100% volunteer basis. For many months, View Park Conservancy members spent more time on the initiative than our day jobs, and spent considerable time away from our families in order to conduct the initiative. And in the end, as you can see here, by the end of the fundraising campaign, there was more than 600 View Park residents collectively had donated just over $100,000 to complete the entire nomination. And as history tells us, the View Park residents have endured racism and discrimination to prosper and raise their families. And now I will introduce one of the members of View Park Conservancy, one of the co-founders, Ben Kale, to read a statement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll be brief. I know we have a lot of supporters here. I want to thank the Commission very much for considering our nomination. This has been a very long road for us. I will say that I've lived all across LA my whole life, and most neighborhoods are really well known for their amenities, the amenities that surround them, such as the beach or Whole Foods or nightlife, whatever have you. View Park is the only place I've lived that's really been known for its people. And that was the impetus for us to get this going and to make sure that that continues in perpetuity. And with that, I'd like to introduce Katie Horak.
Thank you so much. My name is Katie Horak. I'm with Architectural Resources Group. Thank you so much to commissioners for your consideration. I also would like to thank staff for your time and effort guiding us through this nomination, which is enormous. So thank you so much, William and Jay. I actually had a larger presentation prepared, but the staff presentation was so thorough, I want to cut mine short so I can share our limited time with other supporters. But I did want to say that my own history, with View Park dates to about 6 years ago when Architectural Resources Group surveyed an adjacent neighborhood in Baldwin Hills per Survey LA. I drove through the hillside community and was blown away by the variety and quality of the architecture, how unaltered everything is up there, and just the beautiful visual setting. So I was very glad to several years later get the call from Ben and Andre and the View Park Conservancy and have the opportunity to use the neighborhood as a case study for my advanced documentation class at USC. Through the work of my students, we learned more about the incredible social history of View Park and the adversity the African American community faced as they fought to overcome restrictive housing practices in the community and transform it into one of the most prosperous black communities in the country. View Park's story is a great Los Angeles story, both painful and victorious. Thank you so much for your consideration.
Good afternoon. My name is Yolanda Parker, and my husband and I moved to View Park January 1974. We were both computer systems engineers and could have lived anywhere in Los Angeles we chose to, but we chose to live in View Park. And because we wanted our children to grow up in a diverse community that was predominantly African American with professional role models. We were attracted by how well maintained the homes were and the history of View Park, from being one of the first neighborhoods with attached two-car garages to its street names, which reflect the 1932 Olympics, to the architectural styles of homes reflecting the decades of development. One of the first things we learned about for my neighborhood was that this house across the street from us was built by Jack Northrop so he could look down on the Olympic Village. And since we've lived in View Park, that home has only changed three times and has maintained its architectural style. When Andre and Ben approached me about View Park Conservancy and their desire to have View Park on the National Register of Historical Places, I said unqualified yes. In fact, I hosted the very first event at my home and invited our Congress member, Karen Bass, to attend. Once Karen heard the presentation, she also became a huge supporter of this effort. I love the energy of these two young men and was extremely happy that they had moved into View Park and so that they had become an integral part of our community. When we moved into View Park in 1974, our older neighbors welcomed us with open arms, and I wanted to continue that multi-generational tradition of welcoming young families into the neighborhood. View Park is a very, very special neighborhood in that its history reflects the architectural and social history of Los Angeles. I totally 100% support placing View Park on the National Register of Historic Places. Thank you.
Greetings. I'm Dr. Bonita Nicholas, and I'm here, of course, in full support of the View Park nomination. I bought my house in View Park in 1981, and it became a real home in 1983 when I married my sweetheart, Tony Nicholas, who has been my husband for the past 33 years. During those decades, we've raised our three children in View Park, and now our four grandchildren want to call our home their second home. In 1992, my husband Tony was elected president of the United Homeowners Association. It was an organization that represented the residents and homeowners in View Park and adjoining neighborhoods. It was founded in 1979 when hundreds of United Homeowners came together with just two goals in mind. One was to protect and preserve our property and values, and preserve the quality of life that we enjoy in View Park. During the 12 years that my husband was president of UHA, we successfully prevented the building of pawn shops, skating rinks, cell phone towers, low-income housing, expanding oil wells, and prevented building a power plant in the middle of a park that was right across the street from our neighborhood elementary school and our million-dollar homes. This may not sound like a lot to you, but many of these kinds of things impact the quality of life that residents enjoy in the kind of neighborhood that View Park is. And now, View Park is represented by the Conservancy. The voice and representation of View Park Conservancy, of which I am a proud founding member as well as my husband, has now taken over the voice of United Homeowners Association. We have always enjoyed representation and the support of our elected officials, state, federal, and local, many of whom still live in the View Park area. We have an undeniably rich history and legacy, and we have worked for over 24 years in the View Park community to keep it and maintain its status that you have heard about and that you will know about. We will continue to do whatever it takes to make and keep View Park a rich and historic legacy, and the work that we started 25 years ago when my husband became president, and 35 years ago when I moved into View Park, I will do whatever I can to see that it continues to maintain that status for generations to come. Thank you, and thank you for your support because we now need and appreciate your vote. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Pernell Cox. I am a resident of View Park and at 8 minutes. I won't take all 8 minutes. My story is similar to Yolanda's story, except it was my wife and I, we were newlyweds at the time, and we were searching. We were living in Westchester, for those of folks who are familiar with Southern California, so we casted a net. 10 miles north, 10 miles south, 10 miles east, and about a mile to the water. And there's beautiful neighborhoods, right? There's the South Bay, there's the West Side, there's East Los Angeles, East Los. But one night, we were sitting in bed, and I said, granted, there are nice homes there, but what is the South Bay? I mean, really, what is it? So the next weekend, we drove to the South Bay and talked to people. And we did that in Westchester, and we did that in View Park. And the answer was different. View Park had character. It had architecture. It had soul. You know, it had something that made us want to plant roots there and raise our children there. And that unique identifying factor, initially we thought it was intangible until we moved in. And we noticed that the crown molding at our house is similar to the house next door and similar to the house up the street and is a hallmark of the builder at the time. And the people, it's just absolutely amazing, the fellowship events that we have now that carries on the traditions that Benita talked about that was founded with the UHA 30 years ago. So I thank you for considering our nomination because this is truly a remarkable community. It's one of a kind from a history standpoint as well as a people standpoint. Thank you.
Chairman Grund, Chairperson Grandis, and other commissioners, my name is Dr. Simmons, Dr. John Simmons. And I'm a second generation Californian who was born in Los Angeles and who spent my youth in View Park. I rise in the for the nomination of the View Park Historic District. I think that the perspective of history, I no longer live in View Park. I remember not being told, but subsequently discovering that nearly a half of the group that established La Ciudad de la Reina de los Angeles were black. For the View Park nomination, this area has been the site of racial disparity, which has been discussed earlier. However, I had a chance to experience it firsthand. A non-black person had to buy my parents' home for them way back a while ago. Over the years, it has grown to be an active and important part of Los Angeles, as staff and others have described. And it has sent some of its sons and daughters to other cities in Los Angeles with a strong sense of what California has been, and more importantly, what California can become. I strongly urge the State Historical Resource Commission to approve the nomination of the View Park Historic District. Thank you very much for your time.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Adrian Scott Fine with the Los Angeles Conservancy, and I'm here on behalf of our 6,500 members. And I have to say, we couldn't be more pleased to be in support of this nomination. You've already heard, you know, how extraordinary the neighborhood is for its architecture, its views, its character. But what is really extraordinary about this neighborhood is what you've heard from the people. It's a true community. It's very rare. It's one thing that a lot of people don't know about Los Angeles, that we have these types of places. And certainly View Park is one of the best. So the community has done an extraordinary effort in terms of raising funding, building support, and coming together to support this. So we urge your support as well. And thank you.
Hi. While I have some more time, there is one letter that came to us when we initially launched our campaign back in June of 2014 that came from a resident that I would just actually like to read you. And this is from a resident named Rosalind Blackman. It says, I received your letter and I was overjoyed to see the View Park Legacy Fund. But fortunately, it was addressed to my father who has passed away in 1998. Here are a few of my memories I would like to share. All the homes north of Northridge didn't exist at the time, and my brother and father would go over to an area and fly kites, and they would play on their homemade go-karts in the dirt. The apartments in the jungle were something out of a dream. I was one of the first blacks to attend Windsor Hills Elementary School. There were only two of us at the time for a long time. My brothers and sisters came along, and then one of the teachers, my third grade teacher, had a problem with blacks, but the children in general were wonderful to me. All of my friends were white, and all of their parents were doctors and lawyers. I even had a friend whose father owned the witch stand, which is now simply Wholesome. The race car driver, J.C. Agananian, his family lived on Southridge. Then Ray Charles's house was built, and that was the biggest house on the block. Barry White used to drive by in his white Seville and long hair and wave and talk to my dad. Terry and I would walk home from school, and she wouldn't stay long because she had to be at Ike and Tina's house for piano lessons. On my block, which was white teenagers, they would throw trash on the side of our house in protest of us being on the block, and eventually they all moved out. I am so proud to now own the house that I grew up in, and also proud to see this legacy fund. And I hope you keep in contact with me to help me, to keep me updated on all of your accomplishments. Sincerely, Rosalind Blackman of 5109 Valley Ridge Avenue. And this is just one of many the types of letters that we received over the course of our campaign and our initiative to inform residents and to make them even more aware of the enormous history that existed in the neighborhood that many of them weren't aware of. And these types of letters, in fact, were the motivation to keep us going. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. One more minute? No? Okay, you did good. Thank you.
One thing that's important that I myself, as a newer resident, my wife grew up in the neighborhood, and I heard a lot of these stories from her family. One thing that caught my eye as a new resident moving in was the architecture, but the people captured my heart. And a lot of new residents moving in kind of go through the same thing. They're attracted to the homes, but when they move in, they fall in love with the people. And this will only help them better understand what the neighborhood has gone through for generations to come. So thank you.
Thank you. Eight, two more seconds. So, again, since there's no opposition, technically you get another 5 minutes. If not, we can move forward. Anybody else want to speak? Okay, then we'll close both. And I'm not sure if I should, let me ask a question either to William or to but is there anything different since we have some opposition for a district? Is there any difference? Do you understand the question? I'm not phrasing it.
So if the property is, or the properties to be nominated have more than one private property owner, the National Register would allow to have the property objected to only if a majority of the property owners object. And so in this case, I believe it's approximately 1,800 property owners, and only six have filed objections. So we're not close to a majority that would allow the property to be objected to.
Thank you. Do you have any comments?
Nothing monumental to add. It's a pretty monumental nomination and very important for the city of Los Angeles to have a neighborhood of this size become a historic district. It's incredibly meaningful. And again, the citizens have done a great job of standing up and talking about the layers of history and why it's important to your community. And I am in full support of the nomination.
You have energy coming out of you. No. There's no other comments on the motion.
So I moved to nominate the View Park Historic District criterion A and C to the National Trust, move to the Keeper of Trust for approval of the National Register.
The district is nominated only under criterion A.
Correct.
Do you want the motion?
Amend that under criterion A only.
Okay. So can we get a second?
Second.
Alberto seconds it. So roll call vote, Alberto.
Adrian?
Aye.
Beth?
Aye.
Marshall?
Aye.
Rick?
Aye.
And Brian? Aye. So motion carries unanimously. Well done. All right, we've got one more. And staff, you ready?
The Helen Goodwin Renwick House is a two-story Queen Anne-style four-square home with classical revival elements built in 1900. Character-defining features include the prominent conical-roofed corner tower, a graceful porch carried by slender columns with composite capitals, the hip roof of moderate pitch, whose eaves are detailed with medallions. A small guest house at the rear of the building complements the main building with a simplified design and a pyramidal hipped roof. The property is eligible under Criterion A for its role in the early residential development of its neighborhood in Claremont, California, and under Criterion B for its association with community leader, poet, and philanthropist Helen Goodwin Renwick. The property's period of significance is from 1900, when the building was constructed, until 1930, the year of Helen Goodwin Renwick's death. The growth of early Claremont's community and Pomona College was aided by the support of Helen Goodwin Renwick, one of Claremont's early philanthropists. Her wealth came from her marriage to William Renwick, who had developed and owned a lumber mill in Davenport, Iowa, and died in 1889. Mrs. Renwick arrived in Claremont in 1895 and quickly became a patron of local arts, sponsoring social and cultural events at Pomona College. She was known for her interest in a variety of fields, including writing and editing, college activities, church functions, and travel. Her first philanthropic project in Claremont was the William Renwick Gymnasium, named for her late husband, which has since been demolished. Other building projects funded by Mrs. Renwick included a local library and a mission house in a nearby barrio. While some of the buildings funded by her philanthropy survive, the Renwick House was utilized in conjunction with many of her philanthropic endeavors and thus is directly associated with the philanthropic and artistic work of Mrs. Renwick. She held events and classes in her home in conjunction with Pomona College and community churches, including art lectures, Sunday school, and religious study groups. After the death of Mrs. Renwick, the house was used as student living quarters starting in 1948. The property was restored in 1989 with minor alterations to the building interior, including carpeting and conversion from residential to office use. But the building exterior retains a very high level of historic integrity in all aspects, and the building interior retains a substantial level of historic integrity, including staircase balustrades, built-in cabinets, and decorative wainscoting. Plaster walls and ceiling, light fixtures, and interior doors were replaced in the 1989 remodel, causing some loss of historic integrity to the building interior, but retaining sufficient historic integrity for listing under criteria A and B. The nomination was submitted by a third party, Claremont Heritage. No letters of support or objection have been received, but on April 15th, I was forwarded two letters, one from Pomona College and one from Teresa Grimes of GPA Consulting, asking regarding the differences between the National Register nomination, the criteria under which it was nominated, and a CEQA evaluation performed by Architectural Resources Group. Staff supports the nomination as written, and recommends that the State Historical Resources Commission determine that the Helen Goodwin Redwick House is eligible for listing in the National Register under criteria A and B at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1900 to 1930. Staff recommends the State Historic Preservation Officer approve the nomination for forwarding to National Park Service for listing in the National Register of Historic Places.
Thank you. So, we have three cards, two supporting it, and then one that we had discussed earlier. And essentially, not so much opposing, but just as clarification on something and requesting delay. So we're going to go ahead and proceed as normal. So each side will get 2 minutes.
And so each side will get 20 minutes. So there's two for support, and then one to state why it should be delayed. So okay. And again, if you could just a reminder, you can state your names.
Good afternoon again, Chair Brandis, members of the Commission, and Chapeau and the Council. Susan Grant Hawley of the Grant Hawley Law Group, and I'm here on behalf of Claremont Heritage just very briefly. First of all, you have an excellent analysis and support for this nomination from your staff, and I meant to say it with a little Glenn Tressel, but your staff's just done a wonderful job here for you today, and I just want to thank them for this project and also for the Will of Glenn Tressel. We do not want a continuance. There's not a lot of presence here from the Claremont Heritage because we thought it was going to be a consent item. Just learned a few days ago that it wasn't. And despite that, we do not support a continuance, even to get more time to participate in this hearing, because we feel there is great analysis for you in the files, and that there isn't a discrepancy as is being claimed in the file, in the application, and the supporting documents. The City of Pomona College, I guess, is who is requesting the continuance and was properly noticed. And while, as we discussed earlier, and I know the Commission is aware, the plans for this building are not relevant to the question of whether the nomination should be supported. In this case, if this was to be continued to your July calendar, in the meantime, decisions are scheduled to be made by the local agency. And so it is important, timing-wise, that things are going to be happening in the input of this Commission. In terms of National Register eligibility, is something that will be helpful to the local community as decisions are being made in the very near future. So Claremont Heritage supports, of course, the nomination, asks that you do approve it, and Dr. Denise Spooner is here to give you, to discuss the historic qualifications.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
good afternoon. My name is Denise Spooner. I'm the former executive director of the Historical Society of Southern California, also a member of the Preservation Issues Committee for Claremont Heritage. I want to thank the staff for all the help that they lent to Claremont Heritage in preparing the nomination. If there is one person that, especially a woman, that could be seen as being especially important to Claremont's history, it would be Helen Renwick. As you can tell in the report she was, and in the overview that you received, she was someone who contributed a great deal to the arts and to the culture of Claremont. But I would say that it's really her philanthropic efforts beyond just the arts that makes her especially important to Claremont. Claremont is a fairly progressive community today, and pays a lot of attention to issues of social justice. And Mrs. Renwick was really one of the forebears of that kind of tradition in Claremont. She was instrumental in starting an organization called Sukasa in town that created a kind of friendship house for the Mexican-American, Sikh, and early Korean communities in Claremont. What's more, she also contributed land, not just for the gymnasium in Claremont, but also for the library, which is just west of her backyard. So it's just right adjacent to that property. She also contributed land for Pilgrim Place, which started as a home for missionaries and is today a notable historic community within Claremont itself that's home to church workers. So, and as well as all the other, the founding of the Rembrandt Club or being an important member of that. So she contributed a great deal to Claremont's community. Her home did serve as a kind of a meeting place. So the location today is very important to the town. And also because it's part of the college community, it also has that kind of association with Claremont. So we don't really understand why the college is asking that the nomination be delayed. The staff We've heard that they created an excellent report, and so we just ask that you move forward on the nomination. It's very important to the town of Claremont as we continue our tradition of citing and honoring the historic places that have helped to create Claremont the community it is today. Thank you.
In support of the nomination and in support of not continuing the decision on this nomination. As Susan Grant Hawley mentioned earlier, decisions could be made in the interim. And, we all had assumed that there would be any objections to this nomination because of process that is currently happening. Everyone had agreed that this was an important historic resource, and so now we don't think there needs to be any delays in making that here. And one other point, I understand that there were some objections to the nomination based on some interior changes to the building, but those really aren't the important aspects of this. As Dr. mentioned, it's really the association with Helen Goodwin Renwick and the exterior of the building and its setting. Thank you.
So you still have roughly 14 minutes? Good? Okay. All right. So we will now give Twyla, if you can go ahead and reset the clock. Thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Karen Sisson. I'm Vice President and Treasurer of Pomona College. I'm here today on behalf of the college to request that the commission delay any decision on placing Renwick on the National Historic Register, or finding for its eligibility. The reason we are here is that you have in front of you a report compared by Architectural Resources Group as part of an EIR on the Renwick House, stating it's not eligible for National Historic Register status. This is a firm whose opinion you have relied on two prior decisions today, and the application says it does. So there's clearly some discrepancies here. Renwick House sits on the Pomona College campus, which actually is proposed in a current EIR for National Historic status. We take our history very seriously, and we would agree with Claremont Heritage and others that Helen Renwick is key to that history. Not only did she build a gymnasium, but she also was the chief donor of Rembrandt Hall, which is an example of Myron architecture. She also donated to other things on the college, so she is entwined with our history, which goes back 127 years, as she is with the city of Claremont. But we are disturbed by the discrepancies in the two documents. We would like time to have them resolved, to have perhaps ARG meet with the applicant and also have them reviewed by Ms. Teresa Grimes, whose letter you have in front of you, to see if these discrepancies can be resolved. It's very important to Pomona that we deal with our historical resources thoughtfully. And so we would like to have the opportunity to have these elements reviewed and be able to come back to the commission with a consistent application.
Great, thank you. So, all right, I'm not even going to ask. So the proponents have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you would like to use it.
So far as I know, what I remember from that report is that, and I sat in the city in both the Planning Commission meeting on the local action that's proposed, as well as the meeting before the City Council, and what ARG said was that the interior of the home is not significant. It still retains, as the staff report says, some of the very significant elements of that time period, the built-ins, the balustrade, and so forth, but that minor changes have been made in the way of paint and carpet and things like that because it is used by the colleges for offices right now. So it functions as an office building, but it's really the exterior as well as the setting and its connection to in that location, on that site. The integrity of the site is still very much as it was in that time, of course, with the growth over time of the trees and the surrounding buildings and so forth. But other than that, I mean, last speaker said seems to conflict with my recollection of ARG's report. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. So, Karen, if you'd like, you'd have an additional 5 minutes or two.
Between the college, the city, and Claremont Heritage and the college. So this is an unusual circumstance, and that, I think, is all the more reason to have it more thoughtfully considered and looked at to make sure that the nomination is appropriate.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we'll now close the public comment. And William, you have reviewed the recent letter, right? I'd ask that you give your opinion and evaluation of the changes or the differences between the two reports.
I did have the opportunity to review the letter and also the document, the CEQA document, and to compare them. The issue is that the CEQA document is asking a yes or no question. Is this a historic resource for the purposes of the California Environmental Quality Act? And the response was yes, it is. The analysis found the property eligible for the California Register under criteria 2 and 3. The response to that question, if the property was listed in the National Register under criteria A and B, would be identical. Yes, it is a resource for purposes of CEQA. But these are two different analyses performed for two different sets of reasons. So there is no contradiction between the two analyses. There's two different sets of researchers working from different directions to produce different results. And in terms of integrity, the basis for historic integrity for a house, generally the rule is, if Helen Goodwin Renwick were brought forward to today, would she recognize her house? And this is how it looked when she lived there. This is how it looked today. And you can see from the interior, that may be drywall rather than lath and plaster, but the preponderance of the woodwork underneath paint and underneath carpet is clearly visible, which indicates to me that it passes that test, especially because we're looking at this for its association with the work of an individual who did her work here in this house, rather than specifically for its architecture.
Great, thank you. Any commissioners have any comments or questions?
Thank you.
You have a mic that works?
I think it's the point that William just made about this is the place of business, so to speak, for the philanthropist is very important. And you also didn't mention that often the criterion C is mostly focused on the exterior of the building to start with. Mm-hmm. So in this circumstance, and after reading the letter of objection, it doesn't seem to be enough detail or any reason to not move this nomination forward. There certainly is an ability to delist something if information points in that direction. But under the circumstances and given the presentation, it seems as though this nomination should move forward. I do have one question. When you have this criteria, A, B, and C, does one supersede the other, or do they have to all meet all the criteria under A, B, and C to be listed?
A property only needs to be eligible under at least one criterion to be listed.
And this one's listed under 2.
Yeah, the nomination is under 2.
Right.
A and B.
Oh, so it's not even under C.
The nomination was revised after the initial copy was sent to the property owner. It was originally nominated under A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm.
Upon my review of it, the criterion C argument was limited to one paragraph. While the property potentially could be, the nominating party did not indicate knowledge of the architect nor comparative analysis of the style.
Right.
So I felt that the case for National Register criterion C was not made.
Right.
And that was included in the revised copy of the nomination that was sent to the commission. No copy was sent to the property owner because until Friday, as a staff person, I was unaware that there was any concern about the nomination on the part of the property owner. So in fact, they had not communicated with the staff at all to ask any questions regarding the nomination.
Right. Well, you know, it's eligible under A and B. It's possibly eligible under C, and somebody can come in at a later date and add that information and amend and whatever that does to the nomination. And in the same way, if there's information that's found wanting, I suppose something can be. However, under the present situation, as the nomination is written, under A and B, this nomination should be moved forward under our jurisdiction.
Any other comments from the commissioners? Go ahead, Alberto.
It seems to me that the issue in here and discussion is whether the university will be granted extra time to study it. For whatever reason they had, obviously all the material was informed, but they're asking for extra time. I haven't heard that they're denying the results other than there seem to be conflicting positions and opinions. But the university is extra time. Is there anything wrong giving the university extra time?
The only issue I would have with granting extra time is because the applicant was noticed in due time and that the objection came in this late. And while that makes it difficult on both sides, it's not just the applicant asking for extra time, the opponents asking for extra time, it's the proponents were sort of not given the time that they would need to represent and state their case here. So the timing of this to me seems very important. Do you get my drift? If they had responded earlier and in opposition, then the applicant would have had the opportunity to make a stronger case in this public forum. And that didn't happen. The last minute nature of this seems to me to be problematic.
Alberto, you had another question or comment?
So I still think that if the university, which is the property is on their grounds, if they request an extra time to study the report and analyze and maybe come up with the same conclusion as the staff is having, maybe it's a correct thing to do.
I missed the beginning. What would be the correct thing to do?
Is allowing the university to have the period of extension to analyze the property.
Yeah.
I'm trying to recall, I think in the past, there were some item issues that they were granted an extension,
right,
because the information was not complete. there. I don't remember exactly the case, but
right. No, we've done it both. We've had this, you know, request come up several times, and we've handled it differently based upon, you know, what's been presented in the case. My opinion, maybe not legally correct, but my opinion is that the benefit should be given. To the owner that, the owner should have the time, if there's something substantial, to me, that point has not been, solidified. There's something substantial, and just. Just asking for more time doesn't necessarily, in my opinion, justify. Again, our role is to determine whether or not the as narrowly defined as it is, whether it meets the applicable criteria. And I think everybody in this room clearly recognizes this meets applicable criteria, probably both inside and out, and we're only responsible for the outside. So, I agree. I understand your point, Alberto. And yes, we have done it both sides. And I would typically lean on the towards the owner, but in this case, I don't think it's justified. My opinion. Yeah. You know what? There is one. Should go ahead and speak to it.
I just want to clarify that for the commission that this has been properly noticed under 36 Code of Federal Regulation 60.6C. The office shall send written notification of at least 30 days, but not more than 75 days before the meeting, and the property owner received that notice. So this is properly noticed. And because the nomination was complete, the SHPO had the duty to forward the nomination to this commission, if that's helpful at all.
I think it's very helpful because we can't set a precedent for somebody coming in at the 11th hour and just saying, I want more time. We would never get our job done. That's why we have the 30 days notice, or not less than 75, whatever it was. So I think it's meaningful, and it's written for a reason. And I'm not trying to be punitive. It's just that we've watched in other situations where opponents have brought forth a lot of evidence that we had to consider. And in this case, there's just the idea that something might be in a document that wasn't presented, that William did review, and which he didn't even have to, in my point of view. This is a procedure that I think is important.
Thank you. If there's no other comments, then I'll entertain a motion. Either to approve or disapprove of.
Before we make a motion, I just want to ask staff, do we have a formal letter of objection from Pomona College about the listing of the property on the National Register? Do we have a formal letter of objection on file? No. Okay. So I just wanted to make sure that that's understood, that we have no formal letter of objection. And that specifically is important because it relates to the decision that you're about to make. In absence of a formal letter of objection by the owner, you can determine eligibility and recommend listing on the register. If we had a formal letter of objection, it was only for an eligibility determination. So I wanted to be clear that we understood that before you made a motion.
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to move that we nominate the Helen Godwin Renwick House in Claremont under criterion A and B at the local level of significance to move to the Keeper of the National Register to be listed on the National Register.
We get a second?
Second.
Marshall seconds. So a roll call vote. Alberto?
Aye.
Aye. Adrian?
Adrian, aye.
Beth?
Aye.
Marshall?
Aye.
Rick?
Aye.
And Brian?
Aye.
So motion carries. So moving through the agenda, the next item, outlines the some of the properties that were approved on the last in the last meeting. I won't go over them one by one. The next item on the agenda. Here is our public comments, and if you are still here, Dewey Livingston couldn't make it. So the next item is the Chris modernization. You going to say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll go quickly. So this is the CRIS action plan update. We had presented to you in previous meetings the different tasks that are still open. We wanted to provide you with an update and a status of where we are on them. So if you go through each of the tasks, we've indicated what our initial target date was. You'll notice that some of them have passed. For a variety of reasons, staff time, time to incorporate information from partners and such. Some of the dates have moved slightly, and so we've indicated those for you. So, example, the first one is to establish network and security standards. The initial date was April 30. We now have a completion date of May 16th. That's my birthday present from Eric. And we've explained sort of the barriers to meeting some of the deadlines and the items that we've put in place to ensure that those deadlines will be met going forward. It's an item that's in our office, so not for commission action, but because it's an item of interest and something that we work on together, we want to make sure to be responsible and let you know what our status is, what we're doing to make sure we meet the dates, and we'll bring a regular update to you all in this forum and in a public forum so the public's aware of our progress. So, in sort of deference to time, I won't go over each one of them. I'll just ask you to take a look at them. I think we're on a right path. I think that we're listening, we're paying attention, and I think that some of them, as I said, slipped because of other demands that we have of staff and also from partners. But we are paying attention and we're following it, and I have every bit of confidence that this schedule will be met. And as I mentioned, we'll continue to update both the commission and the public at every commission meeting. In the meanwhile, if anybody has any questions, please reach out to me or Janon, and we'd be happy to answer your questions or address your concerns. The second item is the CRIS subscription standard. Eric has been patiently waiting to present this, and I'll just give a quick update that one of the things we looked at when we looked at the subscriptions were how we marry this with the action plan and what's happening with CRIS generally. I made the request that we not extend fees beyond 2018. We have in the CRIS action plan to be finished with what the CRIS model looks like in 2017, thinking that we'd have a year for implementation. We wanted to be sure that those two things married up in 2018 so we weren't confusing users, confusing the eventual format, and doing things that we would have to sort of ask people to manage in a different way. So that was the basis for that. We tried to create a line to make then everything going forward walk hand in hand rather than trying to manage a bunch of different things. So with that, Eric, do you want to give us a quick 5-second overview of all the hard work that you've done on this.
Start the clock, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Eric Allison. I'm the Office of Historic Preservation's CRIS coordinator, coordinator of the California Historical Resources Information System. What I'll do here, you have a staff report and the actual proposed subscription standard that you're being asked to consider, and the staff recommendation is to approve of it. So I'll go through this as reasonably quickly as I can, I suppose. The issue of subscriptions, we've talked about it a number of times, especially in relation to the now almost four-year-old CRIS fee schedule. And the notion here is that if someone wishes to acquire, by default, generally a fairly large or decent-sized set of CRIS data from the inventory of historical resources, and they wish to perhaps get updates to that, a subscription offers an end-user a way to do that. The importance of having a standard is that it's done consistently, somewhat streamlined, because everyone kind of understands the rules, and all of the 9 information centers have the same template to use for negotiating subscription agreements with their users. The staff report talks about the background to that a little bit. It's not something that is happening all over the ICs right now. Really, one information center has active subscribers. One is in discussion, I guess, or really, well, negotiation of an agreement with a single entity. However, we had talked with the commission about establishing the standard and moving forward with it. The Chapeau, Julie's already provided you with some rationale for the end date, expiration date that is being recommended, so I'll not get into that too much. I could bring up the fee schedule. I think I won't. I think and it's there for any questions, so I'll maybe look at it that way. The fee schedule has a number of components to it. It has the part that's relevant for the subscriptions is the cost of the data, the information. There are 3 basic kinds of information: the spatial data or GIS data, the non-spatial data, that is the, you know, what is it, how old is it, what are its attributes, those kinds of information, and then also the actual documents in PDF format. So a subscriber has access to that for historical resources and also for the study reports that all collectively make up the inventory. So it's a menu, if you will, of things to a user can acquire from the CRIS inventory, and as a subscriber, they can pick from that menu, basically. As it says up there, in the existing standard, given the time constraints and the rationale for that Julie talked about, I'll say that in the initial discussions about subscriptions, we had talked about longer length subscriptions, and I expect, my opinion, and is that we'll return to that at some point and talk about longer subscriptions. But given the 2018 date and all the potential changes to the CRIS, we're looking at a shorter term subscriptions. The discount rates listed up there kind of reflect that. The discussions with the ICs about this, you know, the longer term a subscription commitment is made, the more of a discount. The idea that a subscription provides, while it is a discounted cost, it also provides a certain amount of certainty and stability for an IC, because the more subscribers they have, the more they know about their ongoing income, all other things being equal. That's been, I don't want to say it's quantifiably demonstrated, but the South Coastal Information Center has a number of subscribers. Admittedly, some of them became subscribers in order to support data conversion. This model doesn't rely on that approach. In other words, it's not that the subscribers are necessarily paying for the conversion of data directly. They are paying for the cost of maintaining the inventory or helping to support that. A couple of items on there. Per quad fees are on the fee structure. The more USGS quad, the more area you cover, the more maps you bump into, the cost goes up at a cap of $1,000 additional. So that's waived in the subscriptions in addition to the discounts on the data costs. The PDF flat fee is a pretty small amount. It's a $25 flat fee, and that goes away. The other element there that's mentioned is that estimating subscription costs, since you're talking about upcoming data and updates. So if I'm subscribing for a year, how much information will I get at the end of that year? That's not a known factor, so it's estimated based on past inventory additions and updates. In summary, so that's the model. The information centers have a consistent way of reporting those numbers, albeit it's only been in place for, not for a full 2 years, So there might be some issues there with making sure the estimates are done consistently and accurately, but looking forward, the same database, the same report produces the same statistically derived numbers. So it's a very nice, consistent way to estimate how much new information a subscriber will be getting, therefore how much the subscription will cost. So the calculations for that, again, it's available if you want to look at that. The idea is that the subscriber basically is getting either a 10 or 15% discount right out of the gate. They're also not paying for the per quad cost and the PDF flat fee, which again is pretty small. So the discount is not for the shorter term subscriptions. Again, it's a 10% or 15%. If it's over a year, it's 15%. We don't have a really two full years until December 2018, so it's not really a full 2 year subscription at 15%.
So if I might interject, Eric, I just want to say that the fee schedule itself that you all approve has not changed. This is a subscription that allows a discount for a long-term user, in this case not so long-term, but and because you approve fees, you have an action item to approve should you choose the subscription model that gives a discount to those fees.
Yeah, so the calculations I'm referring to are based on the fee structure. So the information center will be provided with a template, a calculation template to use, and they will put in numbers, and the template itself is based on the fee structure. I guess that's the easiest way to say it. So everything is derived from a consistent starting point. And then there are negotiations that might relate to indirect costs, and some, as with the existing fee structure, there's a section at the bottom that allows for negotiations for large purchases and multi-county purchases. Well, a subscription for a multi-county area would involve some back and forth, much like the fee structure would or could. So we didn't want to vary from that and make it fixed. That does present some challenges because there are a lot of potential variables there. ICs individually would probably like to have some flexibility because there are, you know, like I said, it's a menu of choices and they want to negotiate with their customers. So but this keeps it within a framework. It keeps it fairly consistent and everybody knows what the parameters are. And inside those parameters, they can negotiate. So that's the difference between that and just buying it, repeatedly buying the data, buying new data a year later and paying the full amount. The staff recommendation is to approve the proposed standard for immediate use and have it remain in effect until the final commission meeting of 2018. And as has been said, after March 18, 2017, but prior to that proposed expiration date, this office will come forward with either a recommendation to continue the same subscription standard or to update or replace it with a revised one. And that's my report.
Thank you.
Any questions? You know, you may have said it, and I apologize, but is it does a subscription, does the same subscription work at multiple ICs, or is it per IC, a subscription per IC?
Well, there isn't a prohibition against one or the other. We haven't had that come up yet. So we have had access agreements across ICs come up, and I think the subscription doesn't address it. So I would say that it could occur across
ICs. It'd be part of the negotiable.
But it would have to be discussed, and I'm not asking, we're not recommending the commission determine one way or the other. Case by case, I guess what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
But there's, because it's a contract, every host institution for an IC looks at these things a little differently, so we...
Right.
We would have to take that into consideration.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this was already embedded in the negotiation ability. But.
And it is something that we are looking at in the action plan.
It works. Astonishing. So, Eric, if the...
Somebody else must be on.
It's me. It hates me.
Okay, go ahead.
Totally cool. Anyway, so if the commission in its infinite wisdom decides to vote for this, when would it start?
The recommendation is to have it effective immediately. I guess I would just say these things, they are negotiations, so they do take some time. So what that would mean to me is that if someone were interested in a subscription, they'd be made aware that the subscription standard is available and the negotiations will begin.
Okay. Clear enough. Any other comments or questions? Motions?
Can I?
What's that?
No comment. All right, tell me again. Can I make a motion?
You can.
All right, I'm motioning. So I would like to move that we accept the CRIS subscription standard as submitted. And that's it.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, as submitted, and it'll stay the same essentially until December 2018?
Yes.
All right. Does that capture everything? All right, jolly good.
A second?
I'll second.
A second? Oh,
all right.
Okay, we'll do a roll call. Alberto? Aye. Right. Adrian?
Aye.
Beth?
Aye.
Marshall?
Aye.
Rick?
And Brian, aye. So motion carries.
Good. Thank you.
Two more items. Any commissioner comments? Any other commissioner comments? Alberto, you had something to say?
Not yet. Okay, just a few comments. That this, we said this before a couple of times, but it's very difficult to see the different proposed projects, houses, or maybe a map or a floor plan. I know that floor plans is very difficult to find in particular in historical buildings, but at least maybe a map. Well, it's located here in California, you know, versus there, and it's all kind of information that it would be very, very useful to us to understand it. The context, the region, the issue of local, and to a certain degree to bring, be able to. And this other one is, can system that really works.
I can't hear you.
The answer. Obviously it's a static of the stage area, and then the room, the reverberation in this room, and therefore we are here, few seconds delay on the.
Sorry, yes. We agree. I think that CPF did their best to work with what they had, and we understood the mics were all working this morning, so I'm not sure what happened. To answer your second question, and to your first question, we can look in map, into getting maps. That's not a problem. I've got a note.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I do. I have one. What happened to all the photographs this time in our
in the city?
What's on binders?
Don't know.
Yeah, but there were considerably fewer, I thought. And I really depend on them a lot when I'm looking through property and trying to decide.
I don't know.
I just thought there were fewer this time around.
Don't know, but we'll.
Jay, did you not hear the question?
Photos.
Question. He thought there was fewer photos.
Deliberate falsity. This section of binders. I just thought there were very few.
Oh, wow. I thought there was a number of them.
Okay. All right.
We'll note it.
Maybe it's my computer. I don't know.
We'll note it and we'll pay attention going forward.
All right.
Okay. Maybe there might have been something with your, but we'll note it. Okay. Sorry.
More photographs.
In the binder.
In the binder, yeah.
Yeah. I would comment that on the View Park nomination, I don't think there was a map that showed the neighborhood in context of the Los Angeles area. I don't know if it's too late, but I think it'd be a great addition to the nomination to have that. Move on.
Request them though of the applicant.
It's such a great piece of documentation.
Oh. We'll ask you for them.
Regarding the photos, in many cases, because the TIFFs that were submitted are very, very large, they don't fit onto CD, there will often be a PDF document along with the nomination that contains the photos. Like for View Park, there was a PDF of the nomination and a PDF of the photos, and that included all the photos submitted with the nomination. So it might be that it look for a PDF document with the photos rather than the individual pictures that you might have seen in other nominations.
You could switch to Google Drive. All right, Alberto. You? All right. You guys, any more questions? Okay, meeting adjourned.